They cannot take
it off. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Thank you very much, and welcome, everyone. Julene seems to think her mic is not on. Give me a try.
Hello.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, well, yeah. We have a light out over here.
Yeah, okay.
We have a few lights out in the studio. We have, like, mood lighting.
I was just making it special for you.
Thank you, Peter. I think it's really designed to lower my blood pressure.
That's good. We're all real upset, as so many people in this country are, although with this verdict, George Zimmerman, not guilty of second-degree murder or even of manslaughter, which is what I thought they were going to bring in.
Yeah, I hate to be negative and hate to be a pessimist, but I kind of expected this whole damn thing. It's Florida, bunch of racists down there.
Well, you know, one of the things, and I'll tell you, I have not examined every detail of this case. I didn't follow it, didn't watch it. These things just...
But you know the facts.
Actually, I don't.
We talked about it a lot.
Yeah,
when it
I don't know all the facts that were presented to the jury.
Correct.
I was going to tell a couple stories before we get into this. If you want to talk to us about the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman case and the verdict, give us a call. 313-298-WRIF. But maybe you ought to listen to us first, see where we're going. And in numbers...
It's 313-298-9743.
We'll take some emails as well at calltalkyes at... I'm thinking ahead.
calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I couldn't remember that one. When I do remember, my website, some stuff on there about it, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com, our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/nightcall. There was, so far, and this was in the afternoon, 1 million tweets about this, so far, the case.
That's all?
Yeah, well, so what does this all represent? And that's the question. Here was a case, an egregious case, no matter which way you slice it. A young unarmed teenager died at the hands of an armed adult. Again, no matter whether you think it was justified or unjustified, that's one of the facts that we know for sure. I mean, part of the problem is there was only one other direct witness, and George Zimmerman shot him to death.
That's right.
So it's a little difficult. So we don't know. Maybe some of you were hanging on every minute of it and know what was presented to the jury. But I have to say, I don't. I'm more interested in the outcome and the role that this plays in a sort of our national consciousness. I mean, I can understand fully, because I'm there and so is Jalene, with the kind of disappointment in what this represents, that George Zimmerman could be found not guilty. But why, and I would assume almost exclusively white people, are celebratory. They're actually celebrating.
They really are. In fact, I just got a text. I was telling you, a friend of mine, I think those are your headphones, Peter.
Okay.
Yeah. Who is down south, and he's got a bunch of racist relatives, and he said they were, like, joyously celebrating.
Well, it represents the same thing to both white people and black people, is that white people can shoot black people to death without having to pay a penalty.
Yeah.
And the way it's been for the last 300-400 years.
And did you see the story about the woman in Florida who shot at nothing, like a warning shot, and got 20 years?
No.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's to back up your point there.
And for those of you Second Amendment supporters, now George Zimmerman can get his gun back as well.
He's free to go.
He's free to go. And he says that now he wants to go to law school to help others
like him, to help other racists get away with murder.
Well, here, let me tell these stories, though, what I was thinking about. You know that big block club we have in our area, which is you had a little teeny block club. We had a big block club.
I was queen of that.
Yeah, well, there were so few people. You were the only woman.
All
right, let's go on.
I don't think so.
But we have, as you know, a very large block club.
Yeah.
And initially, the people that formed it wanted to form a neighborhood watch group. And I said, you know, we don't have any crime here.
Well, we had that little rash of burglaries.
Oh, that was like few years ago.
2 years ago.
Let me finish.
Enough to scare me.
All right. Okay. Well, yeah, you're right. I forgot. But there hasn't been in like a couple of years. And then they caught those guys. So these people wanted to form a neighborhood watch group. And I said, you know, that's kind of an announcement. This is a crime-ridden area. And what we ought to have is just a neighborhood block club. And eventually that's what we did. But we had some of the people in the group that said they wanted to start a neighborhood watch. That's a very important word, right?
They're up and down the block with
So we met. We met with the community relations police officer of our city. And the first thing she told us, nobody under any circumstances can go out on this armed, even if you have a weapons permit to carry. Right. That was the number one rule, that you could not have a weapon and be involved in this neighborhood watch, because what you were doing was watching. You weren't apprehending. You weren't questioning.
Yeah.
You weren't arresting.
A phone call.
You were watching. Everybody should be armed with a cell phone. That was understood. And the second thing is, under no circumstances intervene if a crime is being perpetrated, even if you see the person is getting away or anything like that. Your sole job as part of the neighborhood watch is to call the police immediately and have them come.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why I do this. I was reading the Detroit News account of...
I don't know why you do this either.
Yeah, but one man said...
Now, what we're talking about this is, you read a news story, say, most likely in the Detroit News is usually where you get most riled up, and then the comments that follow after that.
And here, one guy said, Trayvon, and these white people, they love to call black people by their first name. Trayvon, Coleman. Well, that's his last name.
I mean, Barack.
But in Detroit, at least. So they do. But he says, Trayvon was wandering around in the rain. That was part of it. Well, first off, and the rain is a key part of it.
It rains a lot in Florida. He
wasn't wandering around. He was returning from a purchase to the home at which he was staying. As we know, he had his hands filled of
Skittles
and a popper tea or something like that. The Center for Constitutional Rights says Trayvon Martin was found guilty of being black in a public space. And that's essentially it. So So now we don't know the facts. There was some facts that were presented to the jury. But again, as I said, George Zimmerman killed the only person that was able to contradict his story.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know whether his story was accurate or not. I mean, what struck me, I mean, whatever, you know, people were saying, you know, these right wingers are going crazy. You know, he was a hoodlum and all this, whatever he was. It's hard for me to believe that in a rain with your hands filled with stuff that you all of a sudden you're going to turn and attack somebody that you had just called and said you're afraid of. I mean, it makes no sense.
None of it does.
No sense whatsoever. And do we know? Maybe George Zimmerman had the gun out. Yeah, because at one point he said that Trayvon Martin jumped out of the bushes and attacked him. And it turned out there was no bushes there, though. I mean, I did know some of the facts. Yeah. So George Zimmerman is now a law-abiding citizen once again, and he's going to get his gun back. He says he's going to go to law school to help others like him.
He better watch his back, is all I have to
say. Well, yeah, that's one of the things that... Well, don't say that so... Really, don't say that so threateningly.
But I'm saying he should watch his back. I'm not going to go down there and attack
him. No, I mean that. But that's reprehensible as well. Anybody that would take that kind of vigilante...
I agree with that. Okay. I'm just saying there are people who are pretty pissed.
But where is he going to work? Well, you know, hi, I'm your server. I'm George. I killed Trayvon Martin. Or maybe he'll get a job at a conservative think tank.
Or maybe he'll get a part-time job at a gun store.
Right. Well, this is all very sad. And again, I would just put it out to what does this all represent? Because we used to say Detroit was the murder capital of the United States. I mean, the United States is like the murder capital of the industrial world.
Yeah,
so there,
exactly.
Here is this one incident where a man kills another man. I mean, and it's important, of course, the descriptions of the people. But one of the things that the key to is that George Zimmerman, he said, these a-holes always get away.
Yeah,
right?
He sure did.
And he was going to make sure against least the instructions of the 911 operator that this a-hole, who it turned out wasn't an a-hole at all, but was just a kid returning home, wasn't going to get away. George Zimmerman set everything in motion. And it seems to me that he bears intense responsibility for what occurred. Even if everything that the defense said was true, which I don't necessarily think is true, because we don't know, because there was no—I mean, there were people. They said they thought they heard screaming, who was on top, and all of that. George Zimmerman bears responsibility for this. Was he a racist? There was a lot of people that said he wasn't. Was he a cop wannabe? The most dangerous kind of civilian there is? Yes. Mm-hmm. And we know that for sure.
Did you see the look at all of the smile that he had on his face after they acquitted him?
It made me ill to
the very core of my being, Peter.
I didn't like looking at him when he wasn't smiling.
I know, but and his attorney in there, oh yes, this is so great. I thought, are you people? Yeah. Oh yeah, you are for real.
Yeah.
You are.
Yeah. All right. Usually we yak it up for a bit here, but there's a lot of you wanting to talk about the decision, the court, the jury decided. You know, the other thing is why, and maybe some of you can comment on this. Like I say, I'm just interested in what this represents, because if he would have been sentenced to second degree murder, mm-hmm. if he would have been convicted of second degree murder or of manslaughter, all of that would have represented something. And the not guilty decision represents something as well. The facts of it all are, of course, are important to the individual court case. But the fact that tens of millions of us were so intensely involved in this case and emotionally involved says a lot more. So your ideas about that as well.
Yeah, I'm wondering if there's anyone. We have, you know, a lot of our friends are protesters. A lot of our listeners are protesters. If anyone went down, there was something down at Grand Circus Park earlier
today
that I was unable to get to. So
there were demonstrations. You know, there were
your
much.
Your headphones or mine squeaking?
I said, I don't know, it must be yours.
Wow.
Right. What happens when you have a microphone on and you have headphones on, and if you get too close to the feedback? You know, you've seen that.
If you have them turned up too high.
Yeah, which I usually
tend
get.
To do.
When there was a demonstrations a year and a half ago demanding justice for Trayvon Martin, mm-hmm. that charges be laid against George Zimmerman, there was a couple thousand people downtown Detroit, including me and my friends and what have you. And, you know, one of the things, these defense lawyers, they were asked, what if the races would have been reversed? And he said there wouldn't even have been a trial, meaning that it was this pressure because of race to charge George Zimmerman. Because if a black neighborhood watch guy would have shot an unarmed 17-year-old kid, the defense attorney said it wouldn't even have come to trial, which is nonsense. If this would have been an African American that would have shot an unarmed 17-year-old unarmed young white guy, the black guy would be now in Florida prison.
Just by.
Yeah, he would have been gone without a doubt. All right, let's take some of your calls. 313-298-WRIF. Here's John in Detroit. John, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. Welcome.
Hey, how's it going? Obviously a real polarizing case. Just want to make a couple quick comments. I thought that Gentel was the key witness, and because she said on the phone that she heard Trayvon say, get off, which, I mean, that says it all right there, that obviously I think Zimmerman probably, they probably confronted each other in the alley or whatever, and I think Zimmerman, you know, thinking this was a burglar, grabbed him, and certain Trayvon was like, you know, get off, and the rest is history. And the reason I believe Gentel was telling the truth is because I think this is kind of a key point. She said something during the testimony that was detrimental towards Trayvon's case.
Yeah.
And that leads me to believe that she is telling the truth. And I just want to make another quick point.
Well, let me say that from everything I've heard that and analyses of it, that a lot of the prosecution witnesses were not strong and actually said things, as John is saying, that were detrimental, actually detrimental to the prosecution case. But go ahead, John.
Yeah. And another thing that it just seems kind of astonishing. It's just disgusting. I was watching HLN, obviously, during the case. And this thing was just completely split on racial lines. All the black people said he was guilty. All the white people said not guilty. And you have white people saying, well, in Detroit and Chicago, you know, there's a million murders every day. And these black people. And it's like, well, those people get arrested and they are found guilty.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's a non sequitur. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, you know, John,
what's wrong with all these white people? That's what I want to know.
Here's, you know, I forgot. I was going to tell another story. I got called for jury duty last year, and I went down there, and I was going to hear a case. You know, they actually the prosecutor kicked me off the case.
I got kicked out, too.
When they found out I was a talk show host.
Yes, I got kicked out for the same reason.
Which I thought, what in the hell? Well, you would have thought that they would have let me on. But I'll tell you, without going into the detail, a man was accused of assaulting his partner.
Yeah, that's what I had.
Really?
Domestic abuse case.
And without going into any of the details, what I had heard about it, and I have to say, looking at this guy, I said, this son of a bitch is guilty.
Yeah.
But you know what?
That you can't do that.
But you know what? If I would have heard that case, this goes to the jurors, which you may be, you know, misjudging them. If I would have heard that case, and if they wouldn't have proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the man was guilty, I would have voted not guilty.
I know.
I would have said, in my heart, I know this guy kicked the crap out of his wife, and probably done it about the live-in partner, I guess it was, about 10 times before, which was part of it. But if they, and it could have been the same thing, weak prosecution case, the jury is required to do that. Okay. All right, John, thank you very much. Let's get Rich from Ypsilanti. Rich, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. Hi. Welcome.
How you doing, guys?
We're good.
Good. Hi, Rich.
I was doing okay until I turned on the show, and Jolene actually used a blanket same statement that actually just irked me.
Under your skin?
What was it?
When she called people in Florida racist. Just blanket statement.
Okay, listen, I'm talking about a lot of the racist laws that occur down there. It was a blanket statement. Let me narrow that down for you.
Go ahead.
For example, this particular law.
What? Yeah.
I mean, in the court case, was there not a jury of his peers the way it is around the rest of the United States?
What? It was a jury of his peers? Yeah, that was the other thing. I'll tell you, Rich, that was the other thing that I thought with six women and five of them, I think, were mothers. And I thought they were for sure.
They would be sympathetic.
Yeah, yeah. But it was really, even though there, I think, little I do know about it, I think there was some case for bringing in. Our reason for bringing in second-degree murder, manslaughter, seemed to be, more appropriate.
And I lived in Florida, and I have to say there's a lot, down in South Florida, there's a lot of beautiful diversity, and I loved living there for that part, but there is a lot about Florida that makes me ill, so.
Well, a lot of states.
Yeah.
All right, thank you. Point taken, Rich. Thank you.
Don't be all angry.
Let's see. Here's
stuff,
Kevin.
Rich.
Kevin, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing?
Good.
First of all, I want to say I'm not racist. I'm dating a Japanese woman.
Okay.
I'm a white guy. She says she's yellow, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Yellow, white, whatever. What I have a problem is they're calling this guy a white guy. He's Mexican. He's Spanish, right?
Well, he's not Mexican or Spanish. He's half Peruvian. His father is German. His mother was Peruvian. And from the looks of his mother, as in those countries, there is usually the upper classes are of European ancestry. And then, of course, the Indios, the poor people, are the people of that are Indians. Actually, I was reading a thing in the New York Times today that they were having difficulty kind of identifying Zimmerman ethnically. They were calling him I can't even remember what it was. But, yeah, so I don't know.
But what I see is one American shot at another American.
Okay.
Black, white, yellow, green, whatever the heck, you know?
Well,
I think it's easy to say that.
Don't you think?
Don't you think it might be a little deeper than that?
Let me ask you this. If George Zimmerman would have seen
a little blonde.
A little blonde kid walking with a bottle of pop or tea and a bag of candy, do you think he would have called 911 and said, these a-holes always get away? I don't think so.
I don't either.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate that call.
I think it's easy when you're white to say things like that. I don't know.
Well, that is, you know, there are so many whites that think that African Americans, that black people actually are overprivileged, and this was the remark of the defense attorney.
This is a white privilege
standpoint
there.
This is the
completely remark
of the defense attorney where he said if the races would have been reversed, that it wouldn't even come to trial, meaning that the only reason this came to trial was because of this huge pressure, in a large part led by the whole African-American community in the United States, which is true because they were just going to say, oh, yeah, well, you shot this kid. Okay.
Was an accident. It's all right.
Self-defense.
Stand your ground.
Stand your ground. Right. All right. Here is Stacy. Stacy's in Ypsilanti. Stacy, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a concern about the whole thing when, say, like the O.J. Simpson case, the civil ramifications he had after the fact. Now, what do you think the civil ramifications would be for Mr. Zimmerman from the family of the boy who died?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I just saw the Martin family attorney. What's his name? Crump, isn't it? I think so. And he was talking about they were looking at all their options of trying. And this happened in the South before when state courts would exonerate people that committed crimes of a racial nature. The federal government would bring depriving of civil rights charges against a person. I don't think that's going to happen, actually. I would say not. If someone egregiously harmed you, you have civil remedies. Indeed, George Zimmerman could be sued by the survivors, by the mother and father of Trayvon Martin.
Mm-hmm.
Those are my
headphones.
Yeah,
that's you.
Sorry. So I don't know. That's one of those things we should see. You know, would justice be served if somehow they brought a $1 million judgment against George Zimmerman? I don't know. Maybe
depends on what your values are.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Stacy. Appreciate it. Here is Rick. Rick's in Farmington. Hey, Rick, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, guys. How y'all doing?
Good.
Good. Hi.
You asked that question about where is this going to lead. It looked like it's going to lead to the same place that it's always been. It's just another black that's been killed. And that's sad.
Why do you think, and say it straight, and you know, you've called before, Rick, so let me ask this, say it straight out. Why do you think so many white people think that it's so wonderful that George Zimmerman was exonerated?
It's the same, I'm going to tell you from the same thing. I'm walking across the street. There's a car full of older white people, and all of a sudden you hear the doors go.
Sorry.
Oh, God.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to
That's
laugh.
That's horrible.
I'm laughing at the white people.
The dumb white people.
Barack Obama, if he was standing on a corner in some places in New York City, a cab wouldn't pick him up.
That's right. Same thing. So, I mean, here it is. You got a kid that was stalked. You got a guy that's got a gun on. He's supposed to know the rules.
Yeah.
And then you go, after you've been told by the command what you wanted to be part of, they told you don't mess with it. But you go on and did what you wanted to do. And now, regardless of whether he was whooping on your ass or not, you should have took the ass whooping, not pulled that gun, and said, go on, man, about your business.
Yeah, what kind of man are you? Not.
But no, you killed an innocent. He wasn't even a young man yet. The boy just turned 17.
Yeah.
Now, people might want to say, oh, he's just another black, this man. No, I'm not bad. I carry a gun.
Uh-huh.
And I will use it if I have to. But first of all, I'm not going looking for a fight. I'm a professional gunslinger.
Wait.
All right. But Rick,
one of the things that also this showed, that having a gun is not really great protection, because one of the things that people think about is if they're confronted by somebody that means them or the community harm, that they can stop the procedure by pulling their gun. Instead, it turned out to be an absolute disaster.
Well, see, that's another thing. I've been trained to use my hands to stop you. The gun is just there.
I may have to cut you loose.
I'm sorry to say. See, I'm a pro at this. Yeah. I've been in law enforcement. I was in the service.
Well,
I've been
was a time when I needed a bodyguard in a serious way. Where were you?
I probably had just came home from California.
Okay, you weren't here. I needed you.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've been trained in this. But morally speaking, these people did not use common sense.
These people.
These jurors that was given that job to do the right thing did not do it.
Well, Rick, comment on what I said. I said that, remember I was using the example about the court case that I was in? If the prosecution didn't do its job, if it didn't present enough to convince them, I didn't see the whole trial, so maybe they did.
I mean, Peter, regardless of whether they didn't do their job, there's a kid that's dead.
That's right.
That's right.
That's right. And it's what I said at the beginning of the show. However you cut it, no matter what happened, an adult killed a juvenile, and an unarmed juvenile by an armed adult who started the process by absolutely not doing what he was directly instructed to do at the time the incident occurred.
By law enforcement.
And it's sad that it had to be a black and white situation, which has already showed that racism is still here in America, big, bold, and waving the flag.
That's right.
Well, let me ask you one thing, Rick, because I use this example. Do you think if you were out and got in the similar situation with a 17-year-old white kid from Farmington and you shot that kid dead, you're an adult, you're armed, you're trained, and kid was unarmed, do you think you would just get off?
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that.
Don't tell me you did it, man.
No.
God, Peter.
God, you're scaring me.
No. This kid threatened me. I worked at a prestigious school here in the city of Farmington, and a high school student threatened me. Yeah. And what I told him what a man would do to him, since you want to play with men, he went running like a little bitch, and I lost. Excuse me, I'm sorry, FCC, forgive me.
No, that word's okay. I say it all the time.
Well, wait a minute.
I was threatened that I would be fired or just resign.
Well, here, listen, I have this whole thing when I'm confronted I have this whole litany. It's called like that. All right, so someone confronts me. They're really angry. They want to fight. So I talk, walk. Now, people aren't going to like this one. Run. Tai Chi, karate, shoot.
Yeah. Peter, you're not walking around packing heat.
We don't have to shoot nobody, man. That's the last resort. Because see, there's
Peter,
there's,
you're such an outlaw.
The bad person.
But you don't shoot first. You don't shoot first.
No, exactly. No. I got one more thing. Listen to me very closely.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
The bad person has the ability to do you bad. He has the opportunity to do you bad. He has to manifest his intent to do you bad. Now, preclusion comes in. That's your part, where you do everything to keep this guy from proceeding and doing that. So, therefore, you either walk away, you go around the other side of the car, or you go someplace else. But if he keeps coming.
You got him.
You got him.
Yeah. All right. Got to move on, Rick.
Thanks, Rick, very much
for that. Yeah, and a lot of people say, I'm not running away from any fight. Well, go ahead. You know, I've been in enough fights.
Man, I'm out of here.
I've been in enough fights in my life. Not a lot, but enough. Even when you win, you get your knuckles all cut up and everything like that.
I don't know. I'm a lover, not a fighter.
I will do anything to avoid. But the only people that are ever going to really fight you are kind of crazy people anyway. And what do I care if some crazy person thinks I'm a chicken? You know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
So, you know, there'd be a time when I wouldn't do that. But now, you know, I don't know. All right, let's, got a whole phone load of people. You know, for some reason or other, when we say, okay, we're going to be right back, everybody's, oh, I'm hanging up. Hang on.
Hang on the line.
Hang on.
And I wanted to say that I had put on our page and my personal page for a lot of you who are my friends on Facebook that we were having a local artist, Kobe Solomon, on at 11:30. But because of this verdict, we talked about it and we decided we wanted to give him the proper time. He's got a lot of exciting things coming up for the city of Detroit with his art, and we're going to have him on next week at 11:30. So
absolutely.
We hated to bump him, but he understands fully.
Yeah. So we'll get back to more of your calls. George Zimmerman, not guilty of killing Trayvon Martin.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. 101 WRIF.
Mike Rowe here. So I'm at a Ford dealer talking with customers about how taking care of your car is kind of like taking care of yourself. And I ask, which is in better shape, you or your car? Hint, the answer has four wheels.
Get the works. An oil change, tire rotation, and more for $39.95 or less minus a $10 mail-in rebate. That's $29.95. Click on the banner ad now. Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Rebate by check. See participating Ford dealer for exclusions and rebate details through 8/31/13.
Your worst tattoo nightmare can finally pay off. Your bad tattoo picture or story could win you a $1,200 gift certificate towards Peak Assure from the Skin and Vein Center. Post your pics and stories or get more details online at WRIF.com.
At Advance Auto Parts, summer heat can melt down your car battery faster than a snow cone on a hot dashboard. That's why at Advance, we test your battery for you. Free. Need a new one? We'll install it. Also free. No reason for you to get all hot and sweaty. Come to think of it, no reason to put a snow cone on your dashboard, but that's irrelevant. Fast, free battery installation only at Advance Auto Parts. Service is our best part.
Advance Auto Parts.
Most vehicles, most locations. See store for details.
John, are you sure we chose the right color to paint the living room?
Oh, for chameleon's sake, Val, you look beautiful when you turn blue.
I like it. I'm just not so sure I love it. You know how fickle I am.
Well, you did turn about 30 colors yesterday.
Did I?
Yeah. It's a good thing there's the Valspar Love Your Color Guarantee. If you don't love the color we chose, we get another free.
Really? Well, I guess the only thing to discuss now is dinner tonight. Cricket stir fry or grasshopper curry?
Who's singing mosquito parmesan?
Offer ends 10/7/13. See loveyourcolor.com for offer terms.
101 WRIF.
We are taking it to the next level. Oh, yeah.
The Riff. The Riff.
are back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much, Ann. Welcome back. We're talking about the decision by the Florida court that exonerated George Zimmerman for killing Trayvon Martin. An armed adult kills an unarmed teenager, and he is found guilty of nothing. Dayron Ron, I can't even say that. Daywan Ron writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. The people calling saying they're not racist, I found that when a person feels the need to declare they are not, then it turns out that exactly what they are, usually. Okay.
I already thought the minute he said it.
I'm not trying to put that on anybody,
no,
but let me advise you, that is usually not a good way to start.
When you start that way.
Yeah, I'm not a racist.
We
kind of
go,
but,
okay.
Well, for one thing, they always say, I'm not a racist, but.
Yeah, right, the big but.
Yeah. Anyway, I did want to comment on the Zimmerman verdict, but I just don't have any words for how angry, saddened, and disappointed I am. Well, I feel the same way, but we get paid to do this. One of the things that no one's really getting to is...
What does that mean? We get paid to do this. So.
We get paid to talk. I mean, you know...
But we're as mad as anyone else.
No, I know, but I could have just... I could have just stayed home.
But you... No.
I don't. I mean, it's my duty.
I know.
It's my duty. I mean, I am into this now.
Crazy
sorry.
Crazy talk.
I know. But, I mean, it just really was depressing. But one of the things that no one's really addressed is why has this taken on such national importance? What does this represent, I guess? And also, I don't think anybody's really commented on both what Jalene and I have said, is that George Zimmerman, guilty or not guilty, bears ultimate responsibility for going beyond what he was instructed to do by his racial profiling of this kid who's walking down. He wasn't, as this one person wrote in the Detroit News response column, Trayvon was wandering around in the rain. He wasn't wandering around in the rain. He was walking. The Center for Constitutional Rights said Trayvon Martin found guilty of being black in a public space.
That's right.
Yeah.
And a lot of protests popping up around the country. And I just read that there were some protesters in L.A. blocked a freeway.
Yeah.
Highway 10 or Freeway 10, whatever it is, and threw rocks and things at the cops.
What'd you say? D batteries.
And D-cell batteries.
D-cell batteries. When I've been mad, I just I throw AA batteries because I'm kind of a pacifist kind of guy.
I throw nothing.
Nothing. I don't either. All right. Let's see. Here is Pat in Traverse City. Hey, Pat. Hi. Welcome. One of my favorite spots on the planet. Pat, are you with me? Wow. You know, it looks like it's there.
I know.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to put, just because he or she
it's
is...
It's a she. I know who this is.
Okay. We're going to put she.
Patricia.
All right. Here's Mitchell in Clinton Township. Clinton, hi. Or, I'm sorry,
hi.
Mitchell, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. How's it going, Peter and Julene?
Going good.
Good. Hi.
Yeah, I'm just calling in. I mean, most people have called in on the other side. I'm basically in support of the verdict and believe that George Zimmerman is innocent. And I mean,
of
I think
what?
He defended.
Of what?
Well, he's innocent what he's charged. But what do you think about what I said, that he bears ultimate responsibility for setting the events in motion by doing what he did?
I don't believe so. He's the head of the neighborhood watch.
He proclaimed himself.
Yeah, wait a minute. He was the head.
He was a rogue dude on the street.
He was the head and the only member.
Neighborhood watch of that neighborhood.
Yeah, he was the only one, though. But wait a minute. He was instructed not to stay in his car.
He was instructed to stay in his car.
That's what I just
said. He said not to stay in his car.
Really? Okay, sorry. He was instructed to stay
in
his car. He should not have been armed at all. And if he hadn't been armed, he probably would have stayed in his car. Because he would have thought, if this
maybe
is...
Maybe I'll get shot.
Yeah, because if this
paranoid.
Is one of these a-holes that always gets away, as George Zimmerman said, he would have probably thought, whoa, I better just stay in my car because I've done my job as neighborhood watch.
I made the phone call.
Yeah, I'm not going to apprehend him. I'm not going to question him. What are you doing in this neighborhood? And I'll tell you, there's a comma and then what we call a missing referent there, if you get my meaning.
We know exactly what was said. All we know is the injuries.
Why don't we only know what we know? Because George Zimmerman killed the other person.
Yeah, and he had a broken nose and several lacerations on the on his head. How many times would your head have to be smashed on the concrete before you know that it's time to pull out your pistol and use it?
It's not even clear that he pulled it out. Maybe he had it out before. Maybe he pulled it on him. Who knows? We don't know anything. That's what I'm saying.
I mean, if someone's going to pull a gun on you, if that's how it happens, but you're going to feel a little threatened.
Let's say that, strictly speaking, that the verdict was, in fact, accurate, and that the self-defense, they didn't even pull the stand your ground thing. Am I right or am I not right that if he would have followed the instructions of the dispatcher, if he hadn't been armed, none of this would have occurred?
Well, that's his right to be armed, though. He was licensed to carry that pistol.
You didn't answer what I'm saying. If he would not have been armed, would any of this have happened? No. All right. Wait, I'm sorry. I cut you off.
Yeah.
No. Would any of this happened?
We don't know for sure.
Well, wait a minute.
Would he have shot someone?
Well, he wouldn't have shot somebody, but also he would not have gotten out of the car. Neighborhood watch people are supposed to do that. They're not supposed to be junior cops going out to hold this a-hole so he doesn't get away again.
Okay, I mean, I can agree with you somewhat there, but again, thing with this, bringing this into like a racial issue, a previous caller had mentioned, he's not even white. He's Hispanic. I mean, they're bringing this all white versus black thing into this. He's Hispanic.
Well, you know, they talk about there's black Hispanics, there's white Hispanics, and certainly George Zimmerman being, identification, you can be 90% so-called white, and you're still considered black, right? You can have 10% so-called black blood. I mean, this insane. That's in itself racist. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Let's see. We're getting calls from way up north. Here is John. John's in Petoskey, another one of my favorite places. Go ahead, John. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm driving back, actually. I'm from Livonia. I just wanted to... first of all, I guess it was already brought up, but I think it's my personal opinion here. And first of all, I don't have any skin in the game. I'm not going to go out and protest or anything like that. And I think sometimes that's counterproductive, too. If I'm not affected by something, I don't know why it's necessary to go out and protest. But Trayvon Martin was the only guy in this situation that had the right to use the Stand Your Ground law. He used the Stand Your Ground law because George Zimmerman was pursuing him. He didn't identify himself. He had no identifiable marking on his car. Like if you do Angels Night in Detroit, they put a magnetic light on your car, and you're driving through the neighborhood, and you know, they know who you are. If somebody's going to set fire to a building or whatever, they know there's eyeballs watching them.
Right.
He had no markings on his car. He did not. They don't know if he identified himself to Trayvon Martin before he started pursuing him. Now, if it would have been me, I would have certainly looked for a bush to jump out and take George Zimmerman down, because he didn't identify himself, and I would have been using this. If I would have shot George Zimmerman, I would have used the Stand Your Ground law to protect myself against George Zimmerman.
Well, the other thing we don't know, since George Zimmerman shot to death, the only other witness, maybe he went up to what do we know that transpired? Did he go up to Trayvon Martin so that he wasn't one of the a-holes that got away? And when Trayvon Martin started to walk away, did he grab Trayvon Martin?
Yeah.
And then, you know, I'll tell you, if anybody, you know, I said that whole thing that I would do, walk, run. If I started to turn and walk and someone grabbed me, then there would be a lot of fists and feet flying for sure on my part. And then, and if the person started to fight back, I might just be smacking them every which way, and then the guy would pull out the gun and shoot me. And I, you know, without ever understanding why this had even occurred, because it could not possibly have occurred to Trayvon Martin who George Zimmerman was or what he was doing, why he was, remember he said, I'm afraid this guy is following me.
Yeah.
And, who knows? You know, we live in a crazy country. There's crazy people around. Yeah, I think you're right. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'm starting to increasingly, oh, never mind. Okay. Here is Chuck in Waterford. Chuck, hi. You're on the air. What's up?
Hey, what's going on, guys? How are you doing tonight?
Yeah.
Good. Hi.
Hey, I'm just kind of wondering why everyone's making this into a race thing.
You don't think
for real?
You don't think race had anything to do with it?
I do not.
Do you think of a white? We said this before. Do you think of a blonde-haired kid would have been walking through there with a with some candy and tea in his hand that George Zimmerman would have been calling 911 and say this these a-holes always get away?
Hey, you know what? First of all, I live in a neighborhood where if I see anyone suspicious, white, black, Mexican, whatever, I'm going to walk up to him and be like, hey, what are you doing here?
You know what I would say to you? Who the F are you? Get out of my face. What would you say to me?
Say it one more time.
I said that if you came up to me and said, what are you doing around here? I'd say, get out of my effing face. Who the hell do you think you are? And then what would you do?
If you punched me in the face, then what?
Well, I wouldn't punch you in the face.
No, he would just say, what do you want?
Yeah. I mean, what if you grabbed me? What if you said, maybe this is one of these a-holes that always gets away, and you grab me? And I said, you'd all of a sudden be finding a lot of feet and fists going your way. And if you had a gun, well, I didn't realize that, maybe you'd take it out and shoot me.
I mean, not to be stereotypical or anything, but you sound like a white guy.
Right? Who? Me?
No. Who's on the line here?
I don't sound like a white guy. I am.
You are. But, no, what's our caller's name, Peter?
It's Chuck.
Chuck.
Yeah.
And thank you. And yes, I am a white guy.
Okay.
And
so I just want. No, I just want to say. I just want to say this. The reason I assumed that you're a white guy is because it's easy for white guys to say things like what you just said. That it's not a race issue. It's easy for white people to say that.
Why do you think almost every black person to, and there's a lot of black people listening to it. They say, well, let's hear what these white people have to say about us. Why do you think every single black person in America thinks it's a racial thing?
Affirmative action.
Oh, my God.
Chuck, you got to, I don't know. I was going to say something mean, but I'll
Google
just say,
this.
I'll just say goodbye.
Google
I'll just
this.
Say goodbye.
White.
I don't even know
privilege.
What that means.
Google it.
I don't even know what that means. Why does every see? Well, that's it. Remember, I said a while ago that whites think that blacks have more privilege than white people.
I mean, these because they have all the privilege and they're so clouded by their own privilege.
But there are as this country goes back to the 19th century in terms of income distribution and the white privilege is actually eroding as well. I mean, the upper third is going to be primarily the upper third that's going to be privileged in this country is going to be overwhelmingly white. And when there's the majority of people, and probably in about 20 or 30 years, the majority of people in this country are going to be people of color, brown and black and some yellow.
Melting pot.
The melting pot. Those on the bottom get burned and the scum rises to the top.
Right.
That's the melting pot. So there is this sense, as even white privilege begins to erode significantly, that there's this sense of what he said. I mean, I know our affirmative actions. What the hell is this guy talking about? The largest political party in America is the Party of Resentment.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. 313-298-WRIF.
Doesn't take much to figure out what that was about.
Yeah. All right. Here's Jake in Fowlerville. Jake, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going good. What's up?
Hi, Jake.
Oh, yeah, I'm doing pretty good. I just wanted to talk about this because I come from a real small town, and, there's not a lot of African-American people around here, and, I'm not racist whatsoever. I used to live in Livonia when I was younger, and, all my friends, well, not all my friends, but I had a majority of my friends were African American, and
in Livonia.
This is like the second little
Livonia. There's no black people in Livonia, are there?
Where I was on the outskirts.
Oh, okay.
Well, of course they're on the outskirts, right?
But I just want to say, what is there against Zimmerman being armed? There is the right to bear arms.
Well, that's, but listen.
That's not what we're talking about.
We're talking about a couple of things. when you're in the neighborhood watch...
Self-professed or, neighborhood watch weirdo.
Whatever. You're not supposed to be armed. You're because, you know why? Because things like this happen. Because people get excited. Because a guy like George Zimmerman wasn't trained. Because he had his gun thinking that his Second Amendment rights would protect him. And instead, he winds up killing an unarmed young man. So it didn't work very well for him to have his Second Amendment rights. If he wouldn't have been armed, he would have stayed in his car and would have waited for the cops, and the cops would have come and gone over to Trayvon Martin, two cops, and they would have said, "What are you doing around here?" Comma, missing referent. The cops would not have said that. They wouldn't have said that.
Depends on the cops.
Well, they don't do that anymore. And, you know, the town's a mixed town anyway. And he would have said...
Are you going old school on me, Peter?
And what is he saying? That he's... was he visiting his father? Or his,
yeah, he was visiting a relative.
A relative or something relative. Like that. And it would have ended like that. It would have been pretty typical. A black kid, rousted for being black in a public space. And that would have been it. And, you know, like it happens to black people...
All the time.
Every day. Whether they're poor and, you know, have their heads backwards...
Doesn't
and
matter.
Or whether, you know, you're an MBA.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here is Mike in Romulus. Mike, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing tonight?
We're good. What's up?
Hey, I'd like to ask a question. I mean, nothing against anything that's going on in the show.
Yeah.
I'm not racist at all.
Of course not.
My
go
son
ahead.
And I, my whole family is, you know, Caucasian.
Yeah.
My son dates an African-American daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Been living in the neighborhood for a year and a half now.
Yeah,
he gets a fun, or he gets a gun point right in his face. Not last night, the night before. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Point blank range. Armed robbery.
Okay.
But when I come out the house and I raise a gun, the police are questioning me why I was raising a gun to this suspect. How is that wrong?
I don't know all the circumstances.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it's right or wrong. Sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong. But I'll tell you, it sounds like a very terrible situation.
Too many guns,
in
my opinion.
And sorry you had to face it, but thank you. All right, here is Austin. Austin's in Dearborn. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, guys. How you doing tonight?
We're doing good. What's up?
Just work with me here. I work 16 hours, so my thoughts are a little bit jumbled. But there's a lot of unusual, there's a lot of unknown circumstances in this case. And my thing is, at my young age of 23, if I light my house on fire, killing my wife, my kids, my dog in the process, but for some strange set of circumstances, the fire department can't get here, I put the fire out. Am I a hero, or am I still an arsonist and a murderer?
No, you're still an arsonist and a murderer, I think.
So this guy he's a grown man, starts a conflict with a 17-year-old, and rather than taking his punishment, like a couple callers ahead of you said, Trayvon Martin's the only one that has the right to use stand your ground in this scenario. You know, it doesn't make sense. Regardless, the guy killed someone, whether it's second-degree murder or manslaughter, he should be locked up.
You know, the other thing is, and that's another danger in carrying weapons, if you're getting, you know, the testimony was that he did not have, he was not getting severe injuries from what was happening to him. But it would be very easy for someone that possessed a gun to say, when you start getting hurt like that, your whole system goes into a defense mode. And if you're being bested, it's saying he was, again, we don't know for sure what happened because the other person was killed by George Zimmerman. It's very likely you would go for the gun. Although, as the prosecution showed, I keep saying I didn't follow it. I saw little bits of it. How in the world he was able to pull out his gun with Trayvon Martin on top of him, as was said, is pretty unusual. In other words, he may have had the gun out before, or as you know, we've all been indicating that whatever occurred, George Zimmerman bears ultimate responsibility for it all. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Let's see.
A couple of open lines if you want to call 313-298-9743.
Yeah. Here's John in Toledo. John, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
First, I want to say I am not racist, but I think as soon as George Zimmerman said these angles get away,
yeah,
he was a racist. I believe that he was referring to black people in general. Is these a-holes get away? He's
yeah, I think you're right too.
Yeah,
I agree. You know,
that, as soon as I heard that, because I mean, I had heard people say he was a big brother to he was like a mentor to young black kids and this other stuff. They was trying to build up his character. Well, I know people that coach football, like the Little League football. And I hate to say it, but they are extraordinarily racist unless they have an athletic black kid on their team. And then, oh, yeah, he's the greatest thing ever, Kids, saying, oh, we got a little Jimmy Black. He's awesome. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of people that I see, And I don't think that's right. And I call these people on that. So that's pretty much my two cents.
Well, thank you, John. Thanks for calling all the way from Toledo. Appreciate it. We're going to keep on rolling. Thank you for...
And if you're dialing, I can see a couple lines.
Wait, you can put it on hold right now.
Okay, good.
Okay.
I'm going to put you on hold.
Okay, all right, good. All right, and we'll be right back. We had a lot of other things to talk about.
I think this might be a little bit of a hot button issue
tonight.
The
women's right to choose being under attack by...
Listen, I'll talk about that any week. I'll talk about that every week.
Yeah, we're at a crisis point, though, in the United States.
Misery?
Far right wing Republicans trying to destroy the constitutional right of a woman.
Well, we'll try to get to it, but I say since lines are full, we should stay on track.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
101 WRIF, locking in everything that rocks.
Clipping coupons. Standing in line at 4 a.m. Buying 5 to get 1 free. Maybe it's me, but I don't think it should be that hard to save money. Which is why we made Geico.com so easy. Just a few clicks and you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance. And when you switch to Geico, you can do practically everything online. Report a claim, update your policy, even pay your bill. Click Bam Boom. Visit Geico.com today. Click Bam Boom. I'm rather fond of that one.
Hey bikers, Ann Carlini here, and if it's anything on two wheels, then I've got everything you need to know. The Riff Hog Report, brought to you by Jerry Aaron, the motorcycle lawyer who rides at 1-800-MI-BIKER. See more at WRIF.com/hogreport.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
It's back to the links, July 22nd, the 2013 Riff Rockin' Golf Outing. Details at WRIF.com.
Peter and Jolene, you're listening to Night Call, the Riff award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to our second hour. We're talking about the Zimmerman decision. Armed adult kills teenager. Justifiable, according to a jury in Florida. Your thoughts, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743, and huge protests going on in New York City and San Francisco right now, of other places around the country as well, but Times Square is full.
Huh. And there was 200 people downtown Detroit.
Hey, and for a last-minute thing, a little Grand Circus Park, I thought that was pretty good.
You can go to my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. Also, hey, join us on Facebook, Facebook.com/Night Call as well. Something going through my brain, but I think I will,
carry on.
Later. Carry on, yes, I will. Oh, yes, guest at 1 a.m. Detroit's Cass Corridor has disappeared. It no longer exists.
Oh, it's still there. They don't call it that anymore.
They call it Midtown.
Right.
So I have an interview with a couple of guys that wrote a book about the Cass Corridor, down and dirty in the corridor.
It's your old stomping grounds.
Yeah, hippies and anarchists.
Love
and
it.
Artists.
Poets.
And
musicians.
Poets, musicians, yeah.
Whew.
Yeah. All right.
More of that.
Yeah.
Less of this other crap.
Here's Carter in Detroit. Carter, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you tonight?
We're well. Thank you.
That's good. Listen, I wanted to tell you that I've been a big fan of yours for
years. I just turned 49. I've been listening to your show since I was 17.
Wow.
And I want to tell you, you know, tonight would have been a good night for you to rebroadcast the interview you did with a gentleman that authored a book called Sundown Towns.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Remind us about that. There was signs. I can't even, so long ago. It must have stuck in your mind. Tell me.
What was it?
Sundown towns where if you were black, you couldn't be in there after dark.
Something to that effect. And, you know, this case made me think about that. And I just wanted to also add that if you were able to follow the trial, that Zimmerman had an excellent defense team.
Yeah, he did.
I mean, you know, the signs were there, unfortunately. You know, the man committed murder, you know, but he had an excellent defense team.
Yeah, he did. I think that's it. You know, Carter, I was in, what is it? Oh, yeah, we're into Monday. On Saturday, I hosted this environmental State of the Detroit River cruise that I do every year.
Oh, did you do that again?
Put together
I missed it again?
The Citizens Environment Alliance people. We got about 125 people on this boat, and we go up and down the Detroit River. We see the good, the bad, and the ugly, the very ugly. This time, the ugliest being these big piles of pet coke waste that comes from tar sands processing, and this stuff is all owned literally by the Koch brothers.
Yeah, it is.
So when I went into Canada, this woman who looked in her 30s says to me, didn't you used to have a radio show? And I said, yeah, I still do. She said, oh, I used to listen to you when I was a kid.
Well, I just want to add also, there's a little bookstore in Ferndale. On 9 Mile, whenever I go in there, I ask about you also.
Where?
They know you too.
Which one? You mean the used bookstore?
Exactly. You enter from the rear, for the most part.
Yeah, you can get in the front too. They got the front too. What? That's Martha and what? The library bookstore.
Right. It used to be the women's prerogative, or
no? That's
like
still
that.
There.
Oh, it is.
Yeah,
no, it's not.
Yeah, well, then, but the library bookstore has been there forever.
Yeah,
great used books. Good place to go.
Carter, well, listen, keep up the good work.
Well, thank you, Carter.
Thanks
you for listening for
Thanks
so
for
long
calling.
And realizing that I still and Jalene still have a show.
Yeah,
I appreciate it.
Winston Smith wrote in and said, "I think I'm not a racist, but I'm not sure."
Yeah, really, people.
Just let him say it.
Yeah, don't.
Okay.
I'm gonna give you some good social advice.
So don't laugh at you.
Yeah, no. In general, don't say
I'm not a racist.
All right, I'm not gonna make an assumption that you are. So you don't have to. You don't have to say that, really. Here is John in Howell. John, how you doing? You're on the air.
I'm pretty good. How are you guys?
You're good. Good. Are you with us?
What's up, John?
All right. So the whole thing with me is the whole racial thing, and that's what kind of gets me because.
Yeah, us too.
Yeah, that's the problem. Is you hear there's so many people that, like, all over the country, this is the one story that pops up. How many blacks kill white people and you don't hear about them?
Overwhelmingly.
I don't even know. What does that mean? Why would you even? Tell me the thinking behind that. What does that illustrate?
And let him give him a chance, Peter.
For one thing, overwhelming.
I mean, just give him a chance to
all right.
talk.
Let me just tell you. Okay, go ahead. What does that mean? How is that relevant to what we're talking about?
How is that relevant? Is because the whole racist thing is because a Hispanic killed a black person, okay, or an African American. All right, so you go down to say like Detroit. How many shootings are there daily? Where a black or a white person kills a black person, vice versa, and you don't hear about it, but this is the one case that pops up.
Well, let me tell you, if a black person kills if a black person, like in any poor district that is predominantly African American, like 99.9% of the crime, including murders, are within the same racial group. Whenever a white person in the Detroit area gets killed or hurt or even robbed by a black person, it's in the Detroit news, and they have a photograph of the black person, just so you'll be sure to know.
And on every television.
That it was a black person that did it. So that's not an issue. All right. Thank you. And being in Howell is probably hard to understand.
Truer words.
Here is Robert in Detroit. Robert, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Are you talking to me?
I am talking to you, Robert, if you're Robert.
Hey, thank you very, very much for letting me speak. Yeah, I want to talk to everybody of people of color. Yeah, everybody has their anger going the wrong way. The state law in Florida is what caused this. I don't care what color the person is or was. Had I been in that situation, and I am a concealed weapons carrier, legal in the state of Michigan,
okay,
and there is open carry in a lot of states, and Florida is also one. If you carry your gun in the open, you don't even need a CCW. You can carry.
Okay.
Now, I would not have fired on that young man. That it was not warranted. I don't care how bad he's beating me up in a fist fight. If my life is not in danger, I cannot pull or draw the weapon or pull the trigger. That is the law in Michigan. Florida, all these, what would you say, in New York they got, and then we got in Florida we got people, and then I think the lady said something in Detroit, we had people making demonstrations. You need to go after the legislators. Whatever this stupid law that they come up with, stand your ground.
Mm-hmm. Let me just interrupt you 1 second, though, Robert. I thought
they didn't even bring that
into
it.
I didn't think they
did.
I think they just did it on a pure self-defense basis, that his life was in danger because of the assault by Trayvon Martin, which
I'm a former United States paratrooper.
Okay.
All right. I'm only 5'10" at 205 pounds. Mr. Zimmerman is bigger than I am. Mr. Martin is a lot smaller than I am.
Yeah.
If he's hitting me more than I'm hitting him, well, kudos to him. That does not give me a right to fire on that person.
Well, I agree with you 100%, but here's the thing, Robert. Once a person is under attack, and that's why I'm saying that because of his violation, because of George Zimmerman's violation of what he was instructed to do by the dispatcher, what he should have known to do and not do as the neighborhood watch, to watch and not to try to apprehend anybody, he put himself in a position where any rational process probably left him. I mean, and I'm assuming it from the story we've heard. As I keep saying, we don't know what really happened. Maybe he pulled a gun. Maybe he grabbed Trayvon Martin. We don't know any of this. Remember, he kept saying, that's the key thing. I keep saying it over and over again. These a-holes always get away. And Trayvon Martin was not doing what that one person said, wandering around in the rain. He was looking to get home. And I'll tell you, if I had a hoodie on and it was raining, I'd have my hoodie up.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
What I was to understand was that he had a minor, a 12-year-old, that was home alone. Well, in Michigan, if you're 12 years old and your parents consider you mature enough, you can be 12 years old and be home alone. But Trayvon did not want him home alone, and he was trying to get there, and that's why he was moving rapidly. And like you said, it was raining, and that's why his hoodie was up. You, in the state of Michigan, you cannot fire on that person unless your life or someone else's life is in imminent danger.
Well, that was the defense, that he felt that he was. And, he was, is what I've been saying. He was guilty of being black in a public space. Well, you know, what are you doing around here was his question. All right, thank you very much. Appreciated very much that information. Let me see. I'm just taking these in order, so I'm trying to see the time. Here's Vince in Detroit. Vince, go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, good evening. Boy, it's been a long time since I've spoke to you, Pete Werby. It's very nice to hear you.
Well, hi.
Well, I just wanted to call in and say, first of all, glad to hear you. And secondly, you know, I hear everybody just beating the details of this thing like a dead horse, and I got to tell you, the thing that's the most terrifying and troubling to me is the fact that it's the process, man. It's this law was defective. The court system, albeit, you know, everybody says, oh, we got the best court system in the world. Okay, other people in the rest of the world sure don't think that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, we say crap like that because we live here. But if anybody, if any of these folks had traveled the world and been in other countries and knew how the court system in other countries worked, stop with all this crap about, you know, oh, best country in the world, best legal system in the world. A guy who just shot and killed a 17-year-old boy walked, and it's not because, you know, he didn't feel justified or that he didn't feel that his life was in danger. He did, and he does. But that's still, you know, that's not really what it's all about. He shouldn't have been there. And it's very frustrating to me that we seem to, as a nation, we seem to be continually delving back into, well, if this could have happened, that could have happened. Two people got together. Two people had a confrontation. The guy with the gun won. And that's usually how it goes.
Let me ask a question to you, Vince, and everyone else. And I just thought of this. What if he would have wounded Trayvon Martin and he would have been charged with that, that George Zimmerman would have been charged with assault with intent to do great bodily harm? And what is very, very curious, what would Trayvon Martin have said?
Yeah.
How would he have described the situation and what you so accurately
call the
confrontation? Because right now, there's some suggestions of what we heard from the different witnesses, but no one was really sure, and no one knows what the spark was, and no one knows whether George Zimmerman actually had his gun out ahead of time, and no one knows what he said to Trayvon Martin. And if Trayvon Martin would have said, this and that, and I'll keep going back to this, even if the defense was absolutely spot on, George Zimmerman is responsible for this whole thing, for not following the directions of the dispatcher and for going into that situation armed. And I would say the other thing is this whole thing that armaments are going to keep you safe, this is what George Zimmerman wound up with doing. All right, Vince, thank you very much. Appreciate the call. Oh, yeah, I wanted to get this on. And, Jolene, you mentioned this, and Marissa wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. You were talking. Oh, I'm sorry, it's not Marissa. It's Echo. It's by Echo, yeah. The double standard appears glaring when comparing the Marissa Alexander and George Zimmerman cases. In May of 2012, Marissa Alexander, a Jacksonville, Florida, who happened to be a black woman, was convicted of attempted murder and sentenced to 20 years. It seems she had fired 2 and 3 warning shots against her abusive husband. After her conviction, it seems her defense attorney attempted to appeal under the Stand Your Ground laws, arguing she had been defending herself from her estranged husband. Evidently, she had filed a protective order against him as well. Nonetheless, the judge rejected her appeal.
20 years.
20 years, yeah.
Shooting at nothing.
Okay. Let's take some more calls and get the next one here, which is Tim in Belleville. Tim, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to address the it's not a racist thing, because that really touches a nerve with me. I mean, all I'd like to say is if you saw Trayvon Martin legally carrying a gun and stand his own ground, and the headline said, young black man shoots neighborhood watch guy, what do you think's going to happen? What do you think's going to happen?
Yeah, well,
it's a hands-down case.
That's
I mean,
right.
Like you said, he's in prison.
Hey, you know what? Something about Belleville. I went to Belleville for one of my first times. I went for the first time ever a few weeks ago. It's a very diverse community.
Yes, they are.
I loved it. I was so excited. I just thought it was wonderful.
And I was here.
The area is getting that way, you know.
And it's wonderful.
It just kind of annoys me when the people call in and say, oh, yeah, well, it wasn't racial, because I said, if you just flip that around,
sure,
and you saw Trayvon Martin carrying a gun legally, and some guy's stalking him and jumps him, knocks him to the ground, and so he feels threatened, pulls it out and shoots it. Oh, yes, young black guy shoots neighborhood watch guy.
Yeah, I can see that headline.
Yeah.
All right, Tim, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. And I didn't want to be too trivial, but there's a nice restaurant out on one of their lakes there.
Oh, Peter.
Okay, trivial.
God.
Sorry. All right. 313-298-WRIF.
The lakes are beautiful.
Here's Jeff in Utica.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to make a couple of ridiculous statements
oh.
about the
positive aspects of the George Zimmerman and murder of Trayvon Martin.
Okay, really? let me just stop you. I thought, you know, we didn't say that. Our system blew everybody off that was on hold after our last break. We didn't hang up on anybody. But there someone who called in. Jalene doesn't see this board that I'm looking at. And somebody had called in to say that more people should be like George Zimmerman.
See, it's a good thing I don't see
now,
that.
Now, I didn't
there.
Say that.
No,
I didn't
no, I know.
Say
it
that
you.
At
no,
all.
No, it wasn't you.
I want to point out two positives, please.
Please, no, I know.
I was sarcastic, of course.
Yeah.
One, Obama came out after the verdict and said something, I can't come close to quoting him, about gun violence. We have to reduce gun violence.
Yeah, he said put down the guns in honor,
but
you know, to honor
the... Barack Obama is America's number one gun salesman.
Yeah.
Every time he approaches this subject, gun sales go through the roof. Matter of fact, they pretty much seem to be steadily going through the roof.
Well, yeah, they have been.
But, you, and, know, I wonder, though, there's got to be a point of saturation because the most people don't have guns in this society. And the fact that there's like 200-300 million guns. And, no, people own. Wasn't it you mentioning to me this? Oh, yeah, we won't go there where it was.
Someone we know
was just talking
has a
about,
lot of guns.
Yeah, most people have that are gun owners have extensive armories. So, but yeah, gun sales have been going through the roof, which I always say, I never understood it because we haven't said this in a long time. People would say, well, you know, why'd you buy another gun? Because Obama's a gun grabber. And so we say, well, why are you buying another gun? He's just going to grab that one, too. So instead of 9 guns he's going to grab 14 guns that you have.
Am
I still on the air?
You're still on the air. Yeah, go ahead.
Yep.
Okay, the flip side to these huge number of gun sales is that without question, America is now, without question, the safest country in the world. Why? Because there's only one murderer in America, George Zimmerman. There are no other murderers in America. Just watch the news. 24 hours a day, George Zimmerman, George Zimmerman, George Zimmerman.
I wonder what we...
Yeah, they tend to repeat themselves.
Yeah,
a
I wonder how...
TV, yeah.
I mean, I was looking at the news, and I was thinking about, you know, here, all of this focus. I was watching just the network news and some of the cable news. They're ridiculous, like CNN
and Flow News
and all that. But I was thinking, here's all this stuff going on, you know, that the rights of women are being stripped away by these Republican legislatures. Egypt is exploding.
Mm-hmm.
These endless massacres in Syria continue. You know, I was going to talk a whole thing about minimum wage and how 100 economists want to have the minimum
wage.
Thank you. Raised to $10.50 an hour, but it's all about this one case. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Some open lines, 313-298-WRIF is our phone number.
A quick email from Pat in Mount Clemens. He said, I'm not a racist, but, okay, he's having fun, like with what we're making fun of. You can't bring a gun to a fist fight. Case closed. If anyone doesn't think race plays a factor in this, they're living in a fantasy land. And said, great show as usual. Thanks for listening, Pat. Thanks for the email. calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
We've lost Pat from Traverse City again.
Pat, woman, what's going on with you?
Call back, Pat. Just because we want to talk about Traverse City and how much we love it and all
that.
Yeah,
right.
Here is Mike. Mike's in Waterford. I think I'm going to agree with what he said. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
I just want to emphasize that prosecution did a terrible, terrible job.
Right.
And especially the ball guy with his weak cross-examinations.
Oh.
And,
must be the hair. Let's get on bald people now.
Okay.
Now, what I was thinking.
My best friends are bald. Don't do that.
Yeah. Well, he made very bad challenges. Anyway, I always felt that Zimmerman wasn't on trial. Trayvon was on trial.
You know what? You're right.
That's what a lot of people are saying. It's true.
And one of the things I'll tell you, Mike, if you have the stomach for it, you go to these right-wing news sites, particularly a very famous one that gets enormous amounts of hit, hits, it was everything possible to portray the character of Trayvon Martin in the most negative manner possible, which was to emphasize that Zimmerman was not only not guilty, but in fact he was a hero in this.
Ugh, God.
Yeah.
And, you know, when did six jurors become the norm?
You know, that's interesting.
And when did that happen?
Yeah, it is interesting.
I don't know. What? Maybe somebody knows.
Is it a Florida thing?
It could be state by state. Yeah. Well, to tell you the truth, which I would always do, I'm not even sure where did 12 come from. I mean, that must have some basis in English jurisprudence, what have you.
In law.
Okay, Mike, thank you very much. Appreciate your comments. Yeah, how did we wind up with 12 jurors? What's the history of that?
And then why is there six?
And then we'll have three?
I was curious. Yeah, then it'll be one.
Yeah, right. Well, you can. You can just have the judge do it. It's supposed to be if you're... It's interesting. Usually the rule of thumb is that if you're innocent, you'd like the judge to make the decision.
Yeah.
And if you're guilty, you'd like a jury.
Yes. Yeah. That's kind of the train of thought.
I'm not saying it happened here.
A couple open lines at 313-298-9743 if you want to get in. About a half hour left of the show.
Here's Sean and Warren. Sean, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Bert. Hey, Peter.
Hi.
First time caller, long time listener.
Well, thank you and welcome.
This is just a complete breakdown of our justice system and our intellectual and moral credibility.
Thank you.
I find it absolutely ridiculous. You have white people that are scared now.
Of what?
Well, considering what happened, I mean, the irony is so thick you could cut it with a knife. George Zimmerman is afraid of vigilante justice. I mean, look at what happened. You got chain emails that show, and you can look at this on Snopes, that show Trayvon saying that he was 12, and they show Rapper the Game, who's my age, he's in his early 30s, and he's buff.
What?
The whole thing just reeks of white people being afraid of that meme of the dangerous young black male. It's just sickening.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's obviously what it was about. Those were the a-holes that always got away, according to George Zimmerman, for sure. All right, thank you very much.
I missed the part about the buff 30-year-olds.
Me too, but whatever.
It was intriguing.
Yeah. Here's Ron in Rochester. Ron, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
You're speaking to me?
Yeah,
yes.
You, Ron.
Oh,
Rochester.
Okay. Actually, it's Rob.
Hi, Rob from Rochester.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess part of my manners, this is my first time actually calling in any radio station. I'm only 19. I just thought that with the relevancy of this case that someone from my age maybe, might have some good...
We welcome it.
Oh, thank you. I don't have to disagree. I'm not really going to disagree, but I don't feel that he's completely guilty of being black in a public place. Just because I've grown up in Rochester, which, is a pretty predominantly, more white people there, but I live very close to Pontiac, and I, a lot of times, walk outside, because I live really close to my local speedway with my hoodie on, and I'll go buy, some donuts or something just because it's 2 minutes down the road. And I've had people stare at me and get scared even, I'm like, I look like I'm 14 even, actually, so I look innocent. But I have a story of my friend, actually, in Auburn Hills, when he was 15. He was walking with a hoodie on. It wasn't raining or anything. He's had a hoodie on, and, he's white, actually. And he has earphones and listening to his iPod. And all of a sudden, as he's walking, he gets tapped on the shoulder and then gets tasered. And apparently female cop, an Auburn City cop, I believe, she was following him and yelling at him, telling him to stop. And he was listening to music, so he didn't respond, of course. So she just tasered him. And then, obviously, he pressed charges later, but apparently the situation was that a car was stolen in the area, and he looked suspicious. And I feel like, obviously, if a car was stolen, he probably wouldn't be walking very nonchalantly.
There you go.
Away from a cop.
Usually when you steal a car, you don't walk. You're not walking.
It's the reasoning.
I think it's more of a stereotype thing in general. If you kind of look, I guess, like you're suspicious, like you are wearing a hoodie at night walking around, you kind of just get this general aura coming from you that kind of just scares people or sets them off.
I think there is something to that, but like I say, if it was raining and there was a little more indication. But let's be real. I mean, Rochester, places around us like Pleasant Ridge and Huntington Woods, Grosse Pointe, places like that are what's called Whitetopia. You know, instead of Utopia, it's Whitetopia. It's overwhelmingly, it's the name of a book. It's another author that I interviewed that wrote a book called Whitetopia. And you don't even have to be white to be in there, but it's it's predominantly white. And then you have on the outskirts, Pontiac, Detroit, where that it's first and foremost definition is it's predominantly poor. And then and African Americans in this country are disproportionately poor. This whole leftover from their experience here in the United States, and never, this idea that there's been full integration or post-racial is nuts. There's, still that white supremacy that is still dominant, even though with an African American president and all of that. So if you're living in
Rochester, look what that did. Yeah. That created a whole new.
If you're living in Rochester and you're near Pontiac, and also, I mean, people, these criminologists, they make all these studies. What causes crime? Well, you know what causes crime all over the world?
Desperation,
poverty. I'm not saying that that's an excuse. I don't excuse anybody committing crimes against other people.
But it's a reality.
But it's a reality. It's an explanation. And so if they're, for instance, a young African American from Pontiac wearing a hoodie, walking through Rochester, walking through Huntington Woods, believe it, he's probably going to get stopped by the police, not hopefully by some Yahoo, neighborhood watch guy that thinks that these a-holes always get away. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see some more calls here. Here's Jeff in, where are you at? Carston? Is that what it is?
Clarkston.
Oh, Clarkston.
Clarkston. Okay.
Clarkston. Okay. Missing an L here. All right. I know where Clarkston is. Yeah.
Hey, Peter, let's take race out of this.
Okay, go ahead.
Two men in a fight.
Okay.
One guy's getting beat up. How beat up do you have to be before you take matters in your own hands? I mean,
oh, I know, might just better shoot him?
Well, I told you, I tend to agree if you've decided to arm yourself to then violate the instructions of a dispatcher and you start getting beat up, where is the line? He's asking. You could very well, you, Jalene, me, Peter, whatever. If someone started, smacking you around and the defense mechanism, the reptile part of your brain that says survival, there's very possibly that you would pull out a gun and shoot the person that was hitting. If that's what actually happened. I mean, we know he had a bloody head. We know he had a bloody nose. We don't know what preceded that because we only have the man that killed the other man present to tell his side of the story. But the point being is that George Zimmerman set this all in motion by arming himself and then and he could have armed himself. People say he has the right. We didn't have the right where with my neighborhood watch group, we were told by the police, no one can be armed in these. You can be armed with a cell phone, period. And you do not approach anybody you suspect of a crime. You do not question them. You do not apprehend them. You do certainly don't try to put them under arrest. You are absolutely forbidden to do that. And when you don't, you know what happens? A 17-year-old kid winds up dead.
Well, George lived in that neighborhood. He has the same right to walk in that neighborhood as Trayvon did.
Well,
he was driving around stalking him.
Well, he lives there.
Well, yeah, he has the right to do it.
Right.
But why would he not listen to the dispatcher? If he would have listened to the dispatcher, if he would have followed the rules of neighborhood watch, if he was the self-appointed neighborhood watch captain, why didn't he stay in there? Do you deny that if he would have listened to the dispatcher, we wouldn't have never heard the names George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin?
Well, if Trayvon wanted to punch George first, as the story goes.
As the story goes.
We do not know. He's dead, for crying out loud.
What's Trayvon Martin's story?
Well, he's not here to answer
that
question.
I know. So we don't know. We don't know his side of it. Remember what I said? What if he only would have been wounded? And why are you so hot to defend George Zimmerman?
I'm just taking the other side of the case.
Okay. Appreciate that. Everybody's got to have a defense. You're right. It's the American way. Appreciate mm-hmm. it. All right, Randy and Jack and Dylan and Pat. Is Pat from Traverse City back? Hey, Pat, don't you dare hang up. Don't you even think about hanging up.
Don't make Peter mad.
We're gonna get you, because that's one of my favorite. I have to keep saying this. One of my favorite places on the planet. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. 101 WRIF.
We take this to the next level. Oh, yeah.
The Riff. The Riff.
Attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Divorce is never an easy decision, nor should it be. You didn't get married to get divorced, and if your thinking is right, you won't choose divorce when good alternatives exist. Having said that, if you're a man facing divorce, you should know that, like many things in life, timing is important. Too often guys find themselves in a divorce court when their businesses are thriving, when their investments are appreciating, and their income soaring. Not surprisingly, these conditions tend to produce more painful property divisions and richer support orders. The reverse is typically true when men are in less favorable financial circumstances, when their assets and their ability to pay are diminished. My point is simply this. Divorce may make the most sense for men when they can least afford it. Think about it.
Call the domestic litigation firm of Cordell & Cordell, a partner men can count on. Offices in Troy, Novi, and Ann Arbor, 313-465-1999. That's 313-465-1999. Or visit online at CordellCordell.com. That's CordellCordell.com.
101 WRIF.
That's perfect.
Everything that rocks.
This Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment. Some open lines, and I guess she's Pat from Traverse City. This phone system is just dropping.
It's acting wonky, and it's dropping phones every once, or dropping lines, only during commercial breaks. So that is something that engineering has to figure out for us. I have no idea what's going on, but we apologize.
Here's Justin from, doesn't say where he's from, but he wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He said, maybe you missed the trial, but the subject line is, Zimmerman was not directed by 911. Maybe you missed the trial, but that was part of the 911 testimony. They are not allowed to give orders and have no legal standing to do so. I don't know. The transcripts didn't have any orders to Zimmerman. You state Zimmerman should have avoided the situation, but couldn't Martin have avoided it just as well? What do you mean avoided it? Who knows? Do we know that Zimmerman didn't grab him? Didn't say, you're not, you know, maybe he said, hey, I'm out of here. And he said, you're not going anywhere, and grabbed him. Do we know that? And this is what I could imagine happening. Zimmerman grabbed him because he didn't want this a-hole to get away. One of the a-holes that always gets away.
Here till they get here or whatever.
And he said, I'm going. And he grabbed him by the jacket. He grabbed him by the arm. And bam, bam, bam. And he says, don't forget, Zimmerman passed a polygraph as well. Well, we don't have one for
those aren't even permissible in court.
But here, on the HLNTV.com, Nancy Gray says, in a call to 911 on the night of the shooting, Zimmerman was warned against pursuing Martin, but did so anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, who doesn't know that? Well, I don't know where you're coming from with this.
I think he's saying by law that the dispatcher can't say.
Well, he's saying he didn't even have the prosecution wanted to present a series of 911 calls to establish evidence, who was heard screaming for help, but, the judge ruled against it. Okay. So I think that was the case, in fact. All right, let's see. Where's the next caller here? Here's Jack in Shelby Township. Jack, how are you on the air?
Yeah, how you doing there, Peter? Julian Jordan.
Good. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I live in Shelby. Shelby's between 20 Mile, 26 Mile, DeQuinder, and Hayes Road.
I know where it is.
Okay, look in the Source newspaper. You'll find out what I'm talking about. This week, this week's Source, S-O-U-R-C-E.
Yeah.
Okay.
They had an Army tank, a veteran. He owns an Army tank, and he keeps it in his garage, and he's got a 50 caliber machine gun bolted to the top.
What?
And it actually fires.
What?
It actually has a gas cylinder in it, and it makes the sound of bullets being fired, and it flashes, and he drove it down a residential street on 4th of July at night.
Oh.
And they had frantic callers. I mean, you could check this on a computer. I never heard nothing like that. How could this guy be this stupid? But you want to talk about injustice? This guy drove it down a residential street. The hotliner, the 911, was flooded with frantic calls, you know, because of all the Columbine shootings, these high school shootings, whatever. And the guy was arrested by the Shelby police, and he's been charged with nothing. You talk about a justice system in America. This guy has been charged with nothing. The prosecutor doesn't know. Macomb County doesn't know what to charge him with. Our wonderful township board, Staffikas and Michael Flynn, they're too busy going after a dog rescue.
Take him to task, my friend.
A dog rescue in Shelby. They charge this woman with criminal conduct because she's rescuing dogs.
Wait. What do you think proper charges should be? Driving a tank after dark? Or, I mean, what's...
I don't know.
Owning it.
The right to bear arms. Why, if you have the right
jerk.
To bear arms, why shouldn't you have a... Why shouldn't you have a tank?
Peter, he's going to be...
What? She's having too much fun, folks.
He's going to be in the one-word dream cruise with the abortion bus. They can just follow each other. Idiot.
All right, Jack. Thank you for the story. Hey, see if you can find that, Jolene. So just put Shelby Township tank if you can find it easy enough.
All these people kill me.
Here's Pat from Traverse City.
No,
Pat,
God.
Thanks for your diligence.
Wow. Peter, I've loved you for years.
Well, thank you.
Julian. Yeah, Juween, you and I are pals on Facebook.
We are.
Yeah.
It's good to hear your voice.
Oh, thank you. Hey, Peter, you know, when this whole thing went down last year, they came out with stories that part of the reason that Zimmerman wasn't arrested right away is because his father is a judge. And I'm just wondering how much influence he could have had with picking the jury or, you know, telling them who to pick and even the prosecutor.
Yeah, you know.
And part of the reason they couldn't find him is because he was hiding. Remember
who was
that?
Hiding? Who was
Zimmerman.
Hiding?
Oh. They couldn't find him. He was on the lam.
I don't think, I'm sure the father, Pat, didn't have any, you know, anything to do with it.
Well, you never know.
But, you know, the fact that there was 44 days went by. In fact, you know, that Trayvon Martin's father didn't even know what had happened to him. He thought he had just kind of taken off and gone back to where, Miami? Is that where he went to school? Or
I don't know.
Yeah. And, but no, I don't think that that had anything to do with it because, you know, a couple people have said that the prosecution was not real good. I mean, a number of people wrote me during the trial and said, why aren't they bringing up this? Why aren't they bringing up that? George Zimmerman had incredible representation, and a number of people said that the prosecution was just not up to the task. All right, Pat, let's talk about Traverse City. You ready?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's invited me up there.
I was thinking about coming up as well.
Don't be jealous.
I was thinking about coming up as well, but it's going to be, 90 up there tomorrow, right?
Oh, it's in the 90s today.
Oh, my God.
It is tomorrow. It's supposed to be for the next few days.
Yeah, it's not supposed to be like that up there.
Peter.
You need to tell Juween how good the restaurants are up here. I keep trying to get her culinary skills up here. And,
she knows I'm
and
a
I'm
chef.
A baker. And boy, we could open up one bomb restaurant.
We could throw down, I'm telling you. But I'm busy fighting the right down here with Peter.
When's did the Michael Moore Film Festival already happen?
I think it's coming up.
I think it's coming up this coming weekend or something. Like that. Big,
yeah.
Big film festival up there, Traverse City.
And I always hear that Mario Batali.
Yeah, Batali, yeah.
That he's always up here with his family, too.
Yeah, he has a
restaurant tour.
He has a home in Michigan.
Yeah.
Up north.
Yeah. So and he invites Michael Moore over.
He should invite us over.
Thank you, Pat.
Hey, Peter, come and visit me.
Okay.
I'm lonely.
All right.
Well, I mean, I have my husband, but, you know, we need some good old Detroit people up here.
All right, okay. I'll talk to you.
We are a pretty good time.
Yeah. All right. Talk to you very much. Talk to you very much. What does that mean?
Talk to you very much. Peter,
what time is it?
Stop while you're ahead.
Yeah.
Shelby Township man arrested July 4th after residents called 911 to report gunfire from his tank-like vehicle. Was not driving and did not fire the firearm replica, his lawyer said.
Yeah.
His name's John Lind. He was very remorseful that anybody was frightened by his tank. Huh. This clearly was not his intent to have anybody scared. He brought out his vehicles in the past and did so July 4th to show patriotism. So, tank.
We got...
We've joked about having tanks.
What? Well, for one thing, you know, this little message box here we can get on our screen from John and from Jefferson.
In the other studio, yes.
It says, Justin emailed you before. I don't know what that means, guys. And why does it say Bean here? B-E-A-N.
You guys start tripping in there.
Yeah,
what's going on in
guys,
there?
What are you guys up to? Yeah. Here is Randy in Westland. Hey, Randy, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, I just wanted to say I agree with you, Peter. Once Zimmerman got out of his car after he was told not to, all the blame falls on him. And I did hear the audio recordings. They were trying to diagnose some of the stuff. I heard it on the Internet, and they were even talking about how they could hear his seatbelt on clipping after they told him not to get out of the car. And they're like, he clearly undid his seatbelt. That's him getting out of the car now, you know, because he was trying to save it. The guy's was coming to him, and that's why he got out of the car, because he was coming towards him. So
that's amazing. Could you imagine a 17-year-old seeing an adult in a SUV and saying, I'm going to go up in his face. You know, I mean, that maybe in some, you know, white racist stereotype of the crazed black man, you know, who will, I mean, that's so insane.
Well, who knows what?
I mean, there's so much subtext to this that we haven't even really talked about. But that's it. I mean, essentially, somebody said it. I mean, I wish I would have thought of it. Someone said this essentially was a trial of Trayvon Martin, without a doubt.
A lot of people have said that. I agree.
And as far as what you were saying about the guy's dad not having any influence, he could have had influence in the prosecution not doing their job as well as they could have.
Yeah. Well, you're right. All right, Randy, I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Here is Calvin. Calvin's in Ann Arbor. Hi, Calvin. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, yeah. Well, I mean, I agree that portrayals after the fact seemed, you know, had a racial imbalance to it, and there are definitely racial points to it. But really, that gentleman, it could have been anybody that he thought looked suspicious. He was in his car driving armed with a firearm looking. He joined public, you know, like the watch program.
Well, he didn't join.
He signed himself up for a non-existent watch program. He's crazy. He created his own.
Exactly. That makes it even more point. He was looking for a confrontation. He wanted to make himself a hero. He probably envisioned himself being a hero the whole time he was putting this whole plan into motion. I mean,
well, I guess it didn't turn out so well for him then. He's not a hero, is he?
No, he isn't.
No.
And on the end, other end for the case trial, I mean, the prosecution dropped that ball bad. I mean, whether, you know, we say the defense said this or did that, you know, it was cool or not. I mean, it's their job to basically do everything in their power to get the defendant off. So, I mean, and if they got the defendant off with that much, I mean, it was obvious. I mean, there are so many things pointing to the fact the man should have at least gotten a manslaughter charge or something in that nature.
Well, that's one of the reasons.
Something. Anything.
It wasn't even so much the situation. I was just stunned that, given the situation, given the disparity in armaments, the age and all of that, the fact there are mothers on the jury, when they asked for instructions about manslaughter, because second degree that you had to do it with a depraved state of mind, I thought probably didn't really make it, or they weren't going to be able to prove it.
Yeah.
But I thought, yeah, they're going to cut the difference. The whole country is looking at him, and you know, manslaughter probably would have been. I was quite surprised when they didn't bring that in. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see here. Here is Justin in Madison Heights. Justin, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, sir. I was the one, I believe, that emailed you earlier. I had just gotten off of work, so I just caught the tail end.
The email, Peter, is...
I know.
You know which one it is.
Yeah, yeah. The one that said...
Well, we should explain that, to the listeners.
Yeah, I was going to.
Okay, go ahead.
And it was that Justin wrote in and said that there wasn't at any point that Zimmerman was warned against pursuing Trayvon Martin, but he did so anyway. What makes you think that did not happen? Every other report I've ever seen says that.
If you actually followed the trial, during the trial, they interviewed the 911 dispatcher. Didn't interview questions. One of the big points of contention that came up was, can a 911 dispatcher give a direct order,
and does a
citizen have to follow it? And the dispatcher outright said, we are advised not to give direct orders because it puts us legally, you know, in charge of what happens next. And a citizen does not have to follow our directions.
When you emailed, you said not allowed to give orders. Now you just said they're advised not to.
Well,
what is it?
But they did. And that's on the tape. They're saying, you know, just stay in your car. We're going to send somebody out there. And he completely violated that. And why would he do that anyway? I mean, that's not the job of a neighborhood watch. It's watch. You know, there's the neighborhood watch people are supposed to be, as they call it, the eyes and ears of the community. They're not junior cops. And that's what... that's what Zimmerman was all about, because he didn't want another, as he put it, another a-hole to get away.
Mm-hmm.
Except the only thing was that Trayvon Martin was not an a-hole. He was just a teenager walking down the street and confronted by this guy. An unarmed teenager who meets this guy who's totally stoked about crime.
Yep.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I don't think Zimmerman is an upstanding citizen or anything like that. I do believe, though, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but I believe what the dispatcher said is, you are not, you don't have to follow him. They didn't say, you know, not to. They just said, you don't.
Well, I don't want to parse words. But if anybody has ever had any instruction about a neighborhood watch, you do that. You watch. You don't get out of your car. You don't confront anybody. You certainly don't grab him. You don't try to restrain him. And you don't ask, what are you doing around here?
I just watch from my window like Gladys Kravitz in Bewitched. Remember that show, Peter?
No.
Right. What a shocker.
Thank you, Justin. Let's see. Here's Susan. Pardon me, Susan in Detroit. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I was born and raised here. You know, lived through the riots when way back when, 67.
That's when you went. Yeah.
Ironically, nothing has changed. You know, people just don't listen. People want to take things into their own hands. I moved to Tennessee. I mean, you want to talk about insanity? You can have a gun in a bar.
Yeah,
and
that's too far.
To talk about booze, macho, or whatever, and get pissed off and then shoot somebody. You know?
Yeah,
and it's
angry
like,
drunks with guns, it doesn't really go well together, does it?
No. And you know, the worst of it all is, like you said, he was a 17-year-old kid. This man was told not to do something. He did it anyway, and you know what? People like that are not to be stopped. He felt he was right, and that was it. You know, there was no stopping him.
Yeah, he had it set in his head that that's what he was going to do. He was all riled up.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, you know what? A lot of people get riled up, but we sure as shit don't go out.
Yeah. You said the bad word, so we got to let you go.
Carry on.
But I understand
Carry
what
on.
You're saying. Yep. All right. Yeah, I'm not supposed to. Here's John in Livonia. John, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
I really think it's a travesty of justice that George Zimmerman was found not guilty of second-degree murder or even manslaughter.
Yeah, you know, well, a lot of people agree with you. A lot of people, unfortunately, don't.
I mean, look at the Bob Becerra case. The handyman Getz was found guilty of second-degree murder, and Bob Becerra was a person of interest, and he was found he's in jail right now too due to his actions stuff like that.
He's awaiting trial right now. Is what right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's a travesty of justice that Zimmerman was found not guilty of second-degree murder.
We agree.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your statement. Here's Jeff and Warren. Jeff, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? I do enjoy your show.
Thank you.
And I want to just start out by saying I'm not taking sides, but there seems to be one major factor that's being completely misconstrued here.
What's that?
He wasn't ever told not to get out of his car. He was asked where he was at. He went ahead and got out to look for a street sign so he could give him an address. And at that point, he did start to pursue.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he pursued.
Okay, but
none
wait,
of that
he
other
wasn't.
Stuff matters,
wait, he
really.
Wasn't told. He wasn't told not to pursue at that point. When asked by the dispatcher, "Are you following him?" He said, "Yes." They said, "We don't need you to do that." So he turned around, and upon walking back to his vehicle, he was actually confronted by Trayvon.
Well, wait. Well, how do we know
now,
that?
Now, here's the deal. Right on that, Peter, I just got an email from Brian from Windsor,
uh-huh.
And he said one of the 911 calls has George clearly saying to the 911 operator that he's running and that he was losing sight of him. So George clearly was the one doing the pursuing and engaging a confrontation.
And it says, Nancy Grace, you know who that
and
is.
And that crazy bitch. But
she Zimmerman was warned against pursuing Martin, but did so anyway. George Zimmerman precipitated this entire incident, and you know, whether the prosecution did it or whether, but the other thing is, I keep saying, is we don't know what the Trayvon Martin side was because George Zimmerman killed him.
And how any single one person can defend the actions of this guy just makes me vomitous.
Well, with that, Jeff, I'm gonna let you go. You know what it's all about? too?
Peter? Racism.
Racism, and what's the function of racism?
To keep people down.
There's an economic pie, and it's disproportionately taken by the people at the top, and then the people at the bottom have to just scramble for what's
crumbs.
Left. Yeah. So if you can exclude people because of their gender or because of their race or because of their sexual orientation, then the dominant group gets to, to share on what's left from the master's table. When you start trying to give everybody equal access, well, then it just gets worse. I was reading in the Detroit News today about Oak Park. They're going to have a vote today on whether to allow beer and wine in taverns, one of the few dry.
Well, good city. Luck with that one.
Well, it's just the city council. They don't have to get a referendum that's always lost for liquor.
Okay.
But then it made a point that they had to do all this layoff because it's $3 million short on their budget. And I was thinking then of just reading all of these, the income of these fat cats, of these hedge fund owners.
Oh, yeah, right before the show we were looking at that.
Yeah, and that these guys carry $3 million in their pocket.
Change.
It's not even a rounding. You know, people, if you get like, you know what I mean by rounding? Rounding off something?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, like it was $1.89, you'd say about $2.
Okay.
Yeah, they have so much money. Like
they round it up to the millions?
The millions, yeah. They round it up to the billions, like the Walton family making over worth about $125 billion by screwing ordinary Americans out of
Walmart.
Good wages, yeah, and all that. I'm glad I got that.
Haven't talked about them for a while.
Yeah, well,
have we?
I was just looking at it.
A little pop back up.
And here, these 100 economists saying raise the minimum wage to $10.50 an hour, and what that would do for individuals and what that would do for the economy. And yet the greed heads running things.
They don't want these people to have any quality of life whatsoever. They want to keep every little damn dime that they can. It's mean-spirited. It's greedy. It's disgusting.
Because it actually would help the economy. And
yeah,
certainly,
sure.
I mean, people trying to live on $15,000 a year. $15,000 a year is still almost 20% below the poverty line for a family of three. The implication here being that the federal government says a family of three can live on $20,000 a year. Good luck.
Yeah.
All right, with that, hey, thank you very much for all of your opinions, Jefferson and John.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing the phones.
The phones, and we'll have a podcast up tomorrow.
Today.
Today, around noonish, when Mama Jew wakes up. And also, I want to say one more time, Kobe Solomon, local artist, will be on the show next week.
Right.
I had him booked for this week, but clearly we had a little bit of an issue we needed to deal with tonight.
And you can check our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall, my webpage, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.
Oh, it's chock full of goodness.
All right. Hey, and we got I got a great interview coming. The History of the Cass Quarter, a book on that, and a pretty fascinating interview.
Very nice.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
It's back to the links, July 22nd, the 2013 Riff Rockin' Golf Outing. Details at WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Thank you for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, there are, in most big cities, little districts where what sometimes we used to call the hippies, years ago they called the bohemians, where the political radicals and the artists and folks like that hang out. And if you think of the more famous ones, Greenwich Village or the Haight-Ashbury, but really they're in every city. And we have one of our own here in Detroit. It's called the Cass Corridor. And probably generations of people that fit the categories I mentioned earlier, and some folks that just needed a place to live around Wayne State University, or folks that just lived in the area. Well, there's been an incredible pictorial history of it done. It's in a series called Images of America. The book is called Detroit's Cass Corridor. And joining me are the two authors. They're here with me in the studio, Armando Delicato and Elias Khalil. Guys, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Now, you had a just over-the-top opening at one of the current establishments of the Cass Quarter a week or so ago at the Cass Cafe, and you brought your new book, and my understanding was that at the time you sold way over 200 copies?
Approximately, right.
Yeah, and was that a surprise?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wonder, maybe we should do a little geography. Tell us about the Cass Corridor. You know, I actually talked to somebody, I'm trying to think who it was or what their, well, they had been out of Detroit for a long time, and when I said the Cass Corridor, it was one of my guests from last week, that's right, that he had lived in that area, but had never called it the Cass Corridor. Is that a recent name?
I think it's a name that dates from the beginning of the 20th century.
So it has been there, huh?
The Cass Corridor is part of what was always called the Cass Farms.
Yeah.
Which is a stretch of land that started at the base of the Detroit River and went north for about 3 miles, as did all of the Ribbit Farms, which were how the French divided up the land when they settled it in the 1700s.
And of course, Cass is a famous name, right?
Yes, he ran for president in 1856 and lost. Our only Detroiter who has ever run for that office.
I'm trying to remember whether there's any statues of him around. Is there? I know there's like Hazen Pingree and all that, but there must no Cass statue?
I believe in the Detroit Main Library there's a statue or a bust just of his head, and in Washington, D.C. in the Senate.
Well, this is an incredible, as I said, pictorial history with great captions describing the Cass Quarter from about the 1890s through to the 21st century. What was the impetus for writing this?
I had already written two books about for this Images of America series, The Italians in Detroit and Detroit's Corktown, and I've had a lot to do with the Cass Quarter. I taught years ago at Murray Wright High School down the street, and a number of our students were from that neighborhood. So I had an interest in it. I got two advanced degrees at Wayne State University. I spent a lot of time. But Elias bests me on this one. He actually lives there.
Still.
Yeah, I moved into the corridor about 12 years ago and was always intrigued by what it brought to me as a resident of the city of Detroit. And because of my interactions with Armando, we thought that it would be a great project for us to do a lot more research on an area that was up until that point underrepresented in this series, and it has so much cultural wealth that it was a no-brainer for us to pick up this project and start working on it.
Well, Liz, tell me a little perhaps more in depth, because so many of us that used to live in the Cass Quarter now live in the suburbs, like me. But there's sort of an in-migration occurring, isn't there? There's sort of a revitalization of that district.
There's a phenomenal revitalization that's really occurring underneath the radar right now. I think there's a craving by young people of today here in Michigan for an urban experience. And what's happening is that they've targeted different areas of the city, the Cass Quarter being one of them, to really redefine the area through their presence. And what has occurred in the last 5 years is something that I don't think anyone could have predicted 10 years ago. And it's really an organic movement, and it's really changing the face of the character of the corridor. I think it's all positive, but it's really been a transformation that exceeds any expectations.
The book is Detroit's Cass Quarter. My guests are its co-authors, Armando Delicato and Elias Khalil, and it is published by Arcadia, and it's part of their Images of America. And Armando, tell me a little more that you were starting to. We were off the air about how many of these sort of monographs they have. This is incredible.
There are about 7,500 titles nationwide, and about 150 that are based on in southeastern Michigan. So it's neighborhoods, it's cities and towns, it's buildings, it's ethnic groups, and basically they're all 128 pages and have at least 180 images up to 220. So there's a formula in it that has worked very well for them, and it's very nostalgic. It's basically based on history and delving into the origins of all of these institutions or places.
This is just my allegiance to the area where I still go a lot for entertainment and for food, and friends live down there as well. But is this going to be one of their runaway bestsellers?
We certainly hope so.
there's no doubt. I think that what we succeeded in convincing the publisher of is the necessity to talk about the present as well as the past in this book, which is a departure from their typical formula. So in this book, we talk about the history of the corridor, but we also talk about the transformation that is occurring. And I think that gives it a certain relevance that will increase its appeal to many, many people out there in Michigan and throughout the country who have once called the corridor home.
And we actually had a bit of a tug of war with our editor because we insisted on two of the six chapters are on the present and the future, the looking forward to what's happening. They generally tend to, the Arcadia prefers that we spend time on the past more than the present. But I think we thought that the Cass Corridor story is not complete if you stop at any particular arbitrary point because it's so ongoing, its development and its change. It's always changed, and it continues to do so.
You know, I didn't follow up on what I said. We needed a little geography here for people that need their memories refreshed, or for those who a lot of people listen all around the world. Where are we talking about here?
Okay, we're talking about the neighborhood directly northwest of downtown Detroit. We arbitrarily made the borders I-75 on the south, Warren Avenue on the north, Woodward Avenue on the east, and the Lodge Expressway on the west. Now, the Lodge Expressway and the I-75 are relatively new. The Ribbon Farms actually went all the way up almost to the Grand Boulevard. But because Wayne State has such an immense presence on the northern end of what's the Cass Corridor, we decided to limit the scope of our book to the area south of it. So it's about four blocks wide at that point and about a mile or two long. But really, the Cass Corridor is sort of a state of mind, and it certainly isn't a small town in the middle of the desert. It stretches.
I was going to say, and you can allow those borders to kind of be a little loose, right? Because
correct.
A lot happened on all different sides of it. Just quickly, Ribbon Farms, that might not make sense to a lot of people. The original, we're talking 18th century, right?
1701, when Antoine Cadillac founded Detroit. He had convinced King Louis XIV in France to allow him to build a fort with a settlement. The Quebecois did not really want a settlement this far west, but he wanted farmers so that they could feed the soldiers and raise crops. So what he did is enticed Quebecois to come live along the banks by giving them farmland. And because of the primitive nature of it, this was complete wilderness. The farms were relatively narrow, but very long, so that they would have an opportunity to all live along the river and be able to ship their crops and so forth.
Interestingly, too, for people that might not realize that a section of Detroit called Black Bottom, which was for many years where the African-American community lived, was always thought that it was called that because it was that black people lived there and it was kind of at the bottom of society. But in fact, it had to do with the rich soil.
Right. It was the black soil, not.
Well, I think when people that are familiar with Detroit's Cass Corridor, the name of your book, they would probably locate it directly in the 1960s and think about the MC5 rock band, John Sinclair and the Artist Workshop, the Fifth Estate newspaper, the South End newspaper, the paper of Wayne State University. But we've got a lot of images in here on both sides, and maybe we could start with the cover. Is this on Second Avenue? Am I correct?
No, that's Woodward Avenue.
No?
Right on the left is the Addison Hotel,
okay,
which was renovated several years ago. The parade those people are watching was the Diamond or the Golden Jubilee of the automobile. It was 1946 in July, 50 years after Mr. Olds drove the very first car on the streets of Detroit. He preceded Henry Ford by a few weeks.
So people are all over the roofs of this. Well, and this contrasts, if you will, on page 85, where John Sinclair and the people from the artist workshop and what was called Translove Energy, you can actually see a VW bus in the photo, are on top of a building that's on the John Lodge Freeway. And this, in many ways, the slogan you see there really typifies the era. Maybe, and it's it was written by Jesse Colin Young of the Youngbloods. Maybe you could read it, Armando, what it says.
The words from the song, "Hey people, now smile on your brother. Let me see you get together and love one another right now."
Of course, if we were to bring it up to modern times, we'd say, "Smile on your brother and sister."
Right. Well, this was the beginning of the revolution.
That's right. My guests are Armando Delicato and Elias Khalil, and they've brought out this wonderful book on Detroit's Cass Corridor. And it is for those of us that have spent any time there and continue to, for instance, it's a good reminder. It's memories, and it's also what the possibilities as well that are occurring right now. But it's of interest, I would suggest, that even if you never set foot in that area, or you were never even were from Detroit. Now, as you said, there's sort of a formula here for Arcadia Publishing that's done. What was 7,500? Did you say books like this?
Approximately, right.
And it's 128 pages?
Yes.
Yeah. And so that's every one of them has usually, except for a couple pages, at least two photos on there. Where in the world did you get all the photos?
Well, it wasn't easy. Many of them came from the libraries. The Reuther Library at Wayne State University was a great resource, as was Burton Historica, in the Detroit Public Library. We also
Another source was the Detroit News and their archives, phenomenal archives, that they're just most recently starting to tap themselves, and they were very gracious to open up some of those archives to us to access the photos that they had of the area.
Did you know what you were looking for, or did it grow organically? Like, it occurs to me that I would have thought, where do you start? I mean, how did this develop?
Well, we're both teachers, so we know you start with an outline.
There you go.
And
we
knew that the periods that were most significant, the 18th century, which was distinctive upper class wealthy people who built their homes in the area. Then early 20th century, middle of the 20th century, when it became what people in those days called the slum. Then the Arts and Revolution, we entitled Chapter 4, because this is the 1960s and 70s. And then the last two chapters deal with the present and the future.
But to decide what photos to put in there was really a challenge because of the formula of limiting.
So you had more than you could use.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, of course, attached to every photo is a very colorful story that we could not capture in such short text here. So maybe that's project number two.
Well, I'll bet, too, because, being both a writer and an editor myself, being on both ends of it, you know, writers hate editors. And, of course, editors have so little patience for writers. So I have different hats. I mentioned there was an opening for the book a couple Saturdays ago at the Cass Cafe on Cass Avenue at Forest. And it sold a couple hundred books right there. There must have been some people that came up and said, "You know, I really loved your book, but how come you didn't have..." Did people do that?
Of course, yes, naturally.
I know.
And what's terrible is that as soon as they told their story, we also felt very sad about the fact that this just was such a the phenomenal person, a phenomenal event. But, of course, you have to make choices when you're squeezing all that information into 128 pages.
Well, one of the few things I'd ever quote from Henry Ford, this is the second, he said, don't explain, don't complain. So that's it. Kind of when stuff I've written or when I've published magazines and people kind of complain, I just kind of say, well, okay, there you go. What can you do? Because you guys have done just such a great job of this. And couldn't have this been, double the size? Sure. Could maybe triple, maybe quadruple, because every set of living experiences is just so rich with history, and we're certainly lucky you guys have put together Detroit's Cass Corridor. My guests are Armando Delicato and Elias Khalil, and they're in the studio with me. It's part of Images of America. It's published by Arcadia Publishing. I didn't ask you before, but sometimes people have a website directly to the book. Is there one? No? Okay. Well, you can go to ArcadiaPublishing.com and find it. But I'll have a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and that will take you right to the Arcadia site.
They are available in bookstores,
yeah,
and other stores in the Cass Corridor and actually all through the metro area. Yes, so the large bookstores all carry it.
We would invite you to come visit the corridor and patronize one of the bookstores there and get a flavor for it in person.
Armando Delicato, you said you've had a lot of experience. You're older than Elias in the Cass Corridor. Is there anything you found or anything in here that particularly charmed you or that really hit this chord of memory?
I think the fact that it has such distinct personality at different times in history, and yet it's kind of seamlessly turned over. And I say seamlessly with quotes around it because, of course, it was also the scene of a lot of activity, let's say, during the 60s and 70s that was countercultural, etc. But nonetheless, the Cass Corridor is really a microcosm of Detroit, and I think probably of some of the best aspects of Detroit. So from being probably a precursor to Grosse Pointe and Bloomfield Hills to hitting the bottom in the 1950s as a slum, to nonetheless being a center of such creativity, and really the scene in a lot of ways of the rebirth of Detroit, and I think was very inspiring.
You know, Elias, I was going to ask you a question, and all of a sudden I just had this brainstorm that probably should have waited till we're off the air, but we'll just see how this flies in front of thousands of people. And what I was going to say, as a somewhat younger person, you're living on ground that's already been tread by people, of course, you know,
historic figures.
Yeah, historic figures. And does it give it any, does it pump it up with any greater sense of living than, say, like someplace that was invented like 35 years ago?
There's no doubt that there's an authenticity that you feel when you live in a place, in a space that has history behind it. You know, knowing that I'm a stone's throw away from the house where the Dodge brothers lived and maybe created the first car that had the name Dodge is pretty amazing. And to be able to walk and jog through the neighborhood and admire the architecture that was built at the height of Detroit's wealth in the 1920s, both in the corridor and in the surrounding areas, really helps to put things into perspective.
All right, here's my idea and proposal. You guys are stuck. You can't just say, Werbe, that's a stupid idea. So you're going to have to at least agree to it, and then after we get done, you can say, you know, we're not doing that. You know, I was going to say that in posing that question to you, Elias, that if you go, like, in Greenwich Village, they have walking tours. And you can say, oh, you know, Emma Goldman lived here, or Ernest Hemingway gave a speech here, you know, John, and on and on. What if we set up a walking tour of the Cass Corridor? Are you guys smiling because this is already in the works, or are you loving the idea?
Well, we have so many things in the works. It's amazing what this book has initiated in our minds and in the minds of others. Definitely we would be amenable to walking tours. There are some that are already being conducted by some great groups like Preservation Wayne, which recently changed its name to Preservation Detroit. And we're actually working with a few of the players in the neighborhood to try to create a museum dedicated to the Cass Corridor.
That's great. Well, you know, you have enormous egos when you're in show business, right? Mm-hmm. So I can do it better. I don't know. You know what? I actually don't mean that. I meant that in conjunction, like, for instance, can they show where the Fifth Estate underground newspaper was in the basement of which the MC5 used to practice? That kind of thing.
You are going to be called upon, okay, by the way, when we get to that point right. for that, sure.
Yeah, that'll be the programming in the next bar that opens up. And
so we still don't know, folks. They may just, you know, they as they're walking out, they may be rolling their eyes about it. We'll find out. Well, if this happens, we'll certainly let you know. As I said, Elias, you somewhat younger than Armando, and we were talking about, you know, trotting, and Armando was trotting where people already had as well, so it's not like, you know, that history began in the 1960s or anything, but do you have a favorite photo or a section or anything that really juices you, or can you imagine yourself walking down and, you know, the Cass Quarter in a different era?
I do. There's a photo of Third Street that's phenomenal, where you see the signs for Weber Furniture, which has transformed into the Furniture Factory.
Oh, yeah.
And Anderson Gardens and the Midtown Theater. And there's just a energy, and it's of a bustling metropolis, and it's shown on page 55 of the book. And
okay. We're all...
Every time I jog down that street, I jog down memory lane, even though I never lived it during that era. And my mind starts about all of the redevelopment that has already begun in the area and how it might transform Third to look different in 5 years or 10 years from now.
You know, the Anderson's Garden and the Willis Show Bar, which was at the corner of West Willis and 3rd Avenue, they were known for, well, the Willis Show Bar was known for strippers and what have you, and the Anderson's Garden, for as far as we always heard, was where you could get hookers and what have you. But the Willis Show Bar, which was abandoned, and then became the site of something called the Grinning Duck Club, which was where alternative music and plays were performed, and, you know, a lot of stuff like that. So this was its busiest. I guess I would look on page 20 and 21 and could imagine myself strolling down Woodward and looking at the David Whitney house, which is where now, where's my memory? Oh, the Whitney. Yeah, that's what it's called. Canfield and Woodward, this ultra-expensive restaurant that you can still go and get a beer for $4 and check out all the interior.
But if you go for lunch, it's really quite reasonable.
Really? Armando, because I'm having too much fun. We're starting to run out of time. A favorite of yours? Where would you place yourself?
I have an aerial map showing Cass Park and looking north that pretty well encompasses the entire area that the book covers. And I like that. Probably, well, it's hard to say. It's like choosing which of your children is your favorite.
yeah.
But it is one of the better ones just because it does encompass everything. It's sort of all-inclusive.
All right, let me look at my clock here. We have about 2 minutes left. So maybe we mentioned that you were in a struggle with some of your editors to not just have it history and nostalgia in Detroit's Cass Corridor, the Arcadia book that usually just does history, but rather you wanted to how it is now and how it can be. So those people that are so far that we've just kind of piqued their nostalgia interest, it's going upward and onward, you think?
Oh, there's no doubt that it is the most dynamically moving neighborhood in the city of Detroit in terms of economic redevelopment. We have cutting-edge environmental or eco-friendly buildings going up. The green rehab movement is huge. We have lofts continually being built in the area. Actually, there's a pent-up demand for housing. There's not enough places at market rate for people who want to move into the corridor right now, and it's an exciting problem to have in a city that does have a lot of abandonment. So to see that energy is something to be excited about.
And there's family housing actually west of the corridor, like in the Woodbridge area. Beautiful old homes that date back to the teens of the last century and what have you. Armando, how about you? You have a forward kind of sense of what's going to happen?
It remains, I think it will always remain a diverse community. There's affordable housing interspersed with housing that is quite contemporary and let's call it expensive. So you've got the entire range in the community, and I think that will remain a part of the Cass Corridor from now on as well as in the past. After the 20th century dawned, the community became quite diverse.
Well, I have to say that even though this book is only 128 pages, it's 85-90% photographs we barely scratched the surface of. It's a wonderful read, great photographs. Whether you were there or not, it's worth taking a look at. It's called Detroit's Cass Quarter. It's part of the Images of America series from Arcadia Publishing. Go to arcadiapublishing.com. My guests in the studio have been Armando Delicato and Elias Khalil. Guys, thanks for being with me, and let's do that walking tour.
Absolutely. Sure thing. Thanks.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
101 WRIF. Lock it in.
Everything that rocks.
My mum always says hard work never hurt anybody. Good advice as usual. So we worked very hard to make Geico.com very easy. Say you want to report a claim and follow its progress. You can do it all online at Geico.com. Not to mention perhaps saving a tidy sum of money on your car insurance. All it takes is a few clicks. So visit Geico.com today. Oh, and Mum, if you're listening, yes, I did wash behind my ears this morning.
Mike Rowe here. So I'm at a Ford dealer talking with customers about how taking care of your car is kind of like taking care of yourself. And I ask, which is in better shape, you or your car? Hint, the answer has four wheels.
Get the works. An oil change, tire rotation, and more for $39.95 or less minus a $10 mail-in rebate. That's $29.95. Click on the banner ad now. Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Rebate by check. See participating Ford dealer for exclusions and rebate details through 8/31/13.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. A little, very quick story, first off. The first day of Occupy Detroit in October, there was a demonstration down there, and I went down with a friend of mine to video it, and I was going to do the interviewing, right? That's kind of what I do. And there was a very young woman, 17, 18 years old, with a sign that said, "Eat the Rich." So I said, okay, this will make a good visual, and I'll see what she has to say. What are her policy statements about the disproportionate wealth in this country and all that? So I said, what does your sign mean? And she looked at me steely-eyed and said, "Which word don't you understand?" I went, "Whoa." All right. Well, there's a lot of talk. I mean, having been brought up by the Occupy movement, and not that this is anything new, but it's leaped to the public consciousness. So things like the 1% and the 99% have entered the lexicon faster than teenage slang. And because this goes right to the title of the book we're going to talk about. One of the myths is that the wealthy are the people that create the jobs for it. They're the job creators. And that a lot of what people are criticizing about the way wealth is distributed in this society has to do with envy and resentment. And this is a country in which anyone can do anything financially. The poorest people become the wealthiest. And that's what makes this land so great. Well, is that true? And there is something called the Horatio Alger myth. That was from the 19th century, which saw these poor immigrants like Andrew Carnegie would come over and was a rag picker and, you know, becomes a, in these modern terms, a billionaire. But let's take a look at what that is. There's a book that's just come my way. It's called The Self-Made Myth. It's written by Brian Miller and Mike Lapham, and it's a foreword by Bill Gates Sr. That's Bill Gates Jr.'s dad, and Chuck Collins, who founded United for a Fair Economy. We're going to talk with Brian Miller. He's the co-author of this. He's the executive director of United for a Fair Economy, and he's been doing 20 that sounds like a sentence. He's had 20 years as a community organizer, coalition leader, media spokesperson, writer, and nonprofit director. Let's bring to our microphones from his office in Boston, Brian Miller. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Peter. Glad to be on.
Yeah, thank you very much. And this, your book, The Self-Made Myth, and I should say the subtitle, and the truth about how government helps individuals and businesses succeed. Well, that I don't hear that very much any longer, but that's what it was. It was the Horatio Alger myth that anybody can rise in the class structure. And that that dominated, still does to some extent. That's why you've written the book, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, this book really grew out of the work of United for a Fair Economy and the work we've been doing with high-wealth individuals and business leaders who through our Responsible Wealth Project. And this is an interesting breed of folks who recognize that their success is not entirely their own and that they have an obligation to pay back toward the society that made their success possible through progressive tax policies and so forth. And really, what this book really goes to is how we view the creation of wealth and individual success has profound impacts on the way we view inequality, taxes, the role of government, and more. And for that reason, it's important that we have an honest discussion about that success.
I think so. In your book, The Self-Made Myth, you talk about the top 400 wealthiest people, maybe a third of them were born to wealth. But doesn't that leave two-thirds then that are self-made, mostly men?
Well, I think more specifically, a third of them were born on the Fortune 400 list.
Okay.
More than just being born to wealth. They were born on the Fortune 400 list. The other two-thirds were generally born to wealth as well, perhaps not the top 400, but they made their way there. So absolutely, you know, the reality is that one of the really important determinants in whether a person is successful or not is really the head starts they got in life. You know, were they born to a family of wealth? Were they born white? Were they born male? Did they have connections? I mean, a lot of these, you know, we tell the story of Ross Perot, and his story really had to do with connections that he had. He got a no-bid contract to design the Medicare system and rode it all the way up to extraordinary wealth. The software that drove the Medicare system, I should say, and rode that to wealth. That was about connections. That's about privilege. And that's a big part of determining who succeeds and who doesn't. And that's an important thing to recognize.
The book is A Self-Made Myth. My guest is the co-author, Brian Miller. I think everyone has a story, either they recognize a story outside of their own circle of someone who was born in the working class, sometimes poor, usually born in the working class, yet they say has become rich, which generally means the upper middle class, I mean, below $375,000. Or once in a while, you will find people that will say, hey, look, I was born in a bad part of town, broken family. I had to work three jobs while I went to night school, and now I'm a millionaire. I mean, I did it. Me, my hard work.
Mm-hmm. And there is a narrative about that. And the reality is that there's a lot of factors that actually contribute to individual success. Part of it is those head starts in life I just talked about. Other factors are luck, historical timing. Yes, hard work is also important. But once you've got all that lined up, then whatever success you have is magnified many, many, many times over by all the taxpayer-supported investments that we pay for in education, healthcare, transportation infrastructures, courts and regulations that really magnify the business success of those who are at the top.
Wouldn't you think that most people would understand that? But there actually is an odd support for that sense that it's their money, you know, that they earned it, maybe I've never gotten to be more than just a $13 an hour worker, but someone else who, so in a sense, I had the same opportunity, but even with all that the public tax dollars that go in to support the rise in the class structure, at some level, that it's this American spirit of individual striving and creativity and economic sense of what to do.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there's a certain element of this myth, the self-made myth. And that is, of course, the notion that individual and business success is entirely the result of gumption and hard work and short-term sacrifice. Part of it is it just feels good to pat oneself on the back and say, I did it. You know, it just feels good. But the problem is, again, it's dishonest because there are a lot of other factors that helped one succeed. And more importantly, it's damaging to our political discourse. And while you don't hear the term self-made man heard a lot in today's dialogue, you do hear the echoes of it. You hear the echoes of it every time a tax proposal comes out and someone says, it's their money, they should be able to keep it. You know, mm-hmm. That is, or when there's a millionaire's tax proposed and some conservative pundit gets up and starts screaming, this is going to punish success. You know, all of these words again, the assertion here is that it's their success and their success alone. They created that wealth by themselves. And that really is the self-made myth being echoed time and time again in our modern dialogue. And it distorts the way we view public policies, from the role of government to the role of taxes to inequality. And, you know, coming back to the inequality issue, and this is an important one, because one of the challenges we face, you know, Occupy's done a phenomenal job of raising the visibility of rising inequality in this nation. I can't remember a time in my organizing career where there's been so much awareness that the top 1%, the top 0.1% control such extraordinary wealth. We have a great opportunity before us. But as long as people can rationalize it away as the result of differing work effort, which is what the self-made myth says, then our efforts to rein in inequality are going to fall flat. If we're going to really work to rein in extreme inequality in this nation, we need to go at the ideological underpinnings of that inequality. And that means taking on the self-made myth and pointing out that the success of those at the top is not entirely because they worked harder than everyone else, they're smarter than everyone else, or they made more sacrifices than everyone else. It's not. And that's an important thing to challenge.
The book is The Self-Made Myth and the Truth About How Government Helps Individuals and Businesses Succeed. It's published by Barrett Kohler Publishers, and that's bkconnection.com. There's also a website for the book, selfmademyth.org. There'll be a link on my website as well, peterwerby.com. Well, talk to me a little, though, about the argument that what we see is when people are criticizing wealth, that it's based on resentment, that class resentment, and you treated that partly because, you know, the idea, the myth is that anybody can do this, and when some have and some haven't, well, the haven'ts, they resent then what the haves have, if you will.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's a flip side to this myth. There's a flip side to this myth, which is that if you believe that those at the top are wealthy and successful because they worked harder and they were smarter than everyone else, then you're likely to believe that those at the bottom are there because they don't work hard, because they're lazy, they're slothful. And then if they express any frustration about the current distribution of wealth, you just accuse them of being envious or resentful. And that's entirely not the case. The reality is there's a recognition that the current distribution of wealth and income is simply unjustified. We cannot justify the levels of inequality this nation has based on work, on different work efforts.
How does it work in other countries? Because the tax structure in, say, any of the other industrial capitalist nations is, it's not, the inequality isn't quite like that. In fact, it's dramatically different in a lot of the Scandinavian countries. And the wealthy, I don't know. I mean, the wealthy don't seem to complain so loudly about their tax bite.
You know, it's hard. It's hard for me to speak about how the wealthy in other countries view themselves and relate to the broader politic in their communities. I can tell you what we've experienced with the responsible wealth members. And,
remind people what responsible wealth is, too.
Sure. Responsible Wealth, it's a project of United for a Fair Economy. And through Responsible Wealth, we bring together about 700 business leaders and high wealth individuals who really recognize that inequality is bad for everyone, including them. And these are business leaders who've spoken out in favor of limiting CEO salaries, who've spoken out in favor of a strong estate tax, in favor of ending the Bush tax cuts for top income earners. And part of the reason these business leaders have this differing view is a recognition that their business success and their wealth is only partially because of their hard work. You know, other factors contributed, luck, timing, and the taxpayer-supported investments. And I think the last one is really worth a little bit of discussion because, you know, there are sort of two sets of factors, one of which is this luck and privilege that allows one to turn their hard work into a business success. But the second one is the investments in the common good, the taxpayer-supported roads and education system and other infrastructure, that once a business is successful, once a person is successful, their business success and their wealth is magnified many times over. And the business leaders we talk to, people like Kim Jordan of New Belgium Brewing, Delma Kidd of Davis Kidd Booksellers in the book. They really recognize that their business would not be successful if it weren't for the publicly funded roads, if it weren't for the education system to supply them with workers to design their software or develop their ad campaigns, if it weren't for the court system to protect their copyrights and the regulations to provide a level playing field. And importantly, the higher you get on this economic ladder, the bigger your business is, the more of those public services you're using. And these business leaders recognize, because of that, it's only right and fair that they pay a higher percentage of their income back towards supporting those very structures that makes their success possible.
Brian Miller, you have any idea what the wealthy do with their money? I mean, once they've gotten every single bauble and car and island and what have you, if you have a wealth of $25 billion, you obviously can't consume up to that. I mean, I don't know what, I mean, someone ought to work on that. What's the maximum anybody could consume? I'm sure it would probably be in the low, maybe $100 million at the most or something like that. So where is their money, and do they do anything with it, or does it just pop up on a list every year?
Well, I think, you know, there's been a big case made by a lot of folks that once you have so much wealth in so few people's hands, that you stop running out of usable things to do with it.
Sure.
And it fuels, and it's part of what fueled this heat up to the economic collapse is, you know, people started betting on, Wall Street basically turned into a casino, and people started betting on things that didn't even exist. You know, there were whole investments around derivatives, which means you're not buying anything. You're just buying the concept of whether the Dow goes up or down. And that's what happens when you have so much wealth in so few hands, and it sends the markets wildly fluctuating, and it's not productive. It's not productive for our economy. And, you know, one of the people we quote in the book, Garrett Gruner, he's the founder of Ask.com, makes a really compelling case that, you know, we need to stop thinking that more money in the hands of investors is going to help the economy, because as long as we have the kind of inequality that we have and there's not money in the hands of middle-class Americans, it doesn't matter how much money investors have. They're not going to invest it if there's no one to buy what they produce.
Yeah, that goes back to that whole supply side. That is, in other words, the more that the so-called job creators have to invest, the more jobs they will tend to create, as opposed to demand side, which means the more money we have, the more we'll spend, and then, you know, hence that will create more jobs. I don't know why that seems so self-evident, particularly what's happened over the last few years. I don't know why it hasn't sunk in to these guys. The book is The Self-Made Myth and the Truth About How Government Helps Individuals and Businesses Succeed. There's a website for it, which is the selfmademyth.org. There's no, am I saying it right? There's not the in there, right? It's just selfmademyth.org. And my guest is Brian Miller. He's the co-author of it with Mike Latham. Actually, I've said his name differently twice. Is it Latham? Is that how you say it?
It's Lapham.
Lapham. Okay. That was the third way. All right. We got it right this time. And let's go into, I'm looking at the clock. This is starting to go quickly by. I just read an article, in fact, a series of articles about the reappearance of Ayn Rand, or Ayn Rand, as her followers like to call her, Ayn Rand's novel Atlas Shrugged, to the point where people like the Koch brothers, K-O-C-H, Koch brothers and others are financing the distribution of her novel Atlas Shrugged, a horrid piece of prose, which I could never understand its popularity. But in any event, that these corporate interests are penetrating her novel Atlas Shrugged into the school systems around the country, including universities. What is their interest in Atlas Shrugged and Ayn Rand? And you mentioned it a considerable number of times in The Self-Made Myth.
Yeah, you know, in The Self-Made Myth, we talk about, you know, when we go back and we trace the history of this narrative throughout our country, really, Atlas Shrugged, the novel written by Ayn Rand, is really, it's almost Horatio Alger on steroids. Because not only are the heroes in Ayn Rand's books responsible for their own success and well-being, but they're responsible for the success and well-being of the entire nation. we're essentially all riding on their coattails. And as her title suggests, Atlas is, of course, the Greek Titan who holds up the entire world on his shoulders. And this really is, when you hear a lot of rhetoric coming from those on the right about, you know, the job creators, that's who they're talking about. They're talking about Rand's Atlas, Rand's hero, in her novels. And the important thing we point out in the book is that Ayn Rand and Horatio Alger, for that matter, were novelists. Mm-hmm. They were fiction writers. They were writing stories based on the way they viewed the world. So when we came to discount this, when we came to deconstruct this myth, we interviewed real business leaders. So the people we're talking about, this is what business looks like on the ground in real life, not in the fictional imagination of a 1950s writer. And that's an important distinction to make, because once you see the way business works in the real world, it's very clear that public structures, you know, that investments in the common good play a major role in their business success. And if we're really going to lift up this nation, if we're really going to foster an era of renewed prosperity, we need to begin ending all the wasteful tax giveaways to the wealthy and using that money to invest in the infrastructure we all share as a nation, from a robust education system to, you know, the kind of courts and regulations that provide the stability and protection we all need.
Well, I guess it's a mystery to me, and not really, but I'll pose it like a mystery to me, why these billionaires like the Koch brothers and others would spend millions of dollars a year to distribute a novel that's more than a half a century old. What do they think will be the result of, I mean, well, obviously they want to influence people's concept, but are they just trying to make everybody think that they're really nice guys instead of, you know, the bad guys in the scenario?
Well, I think what it goes to is that they recognize that the self-made myth serves a political agenda. They recognize the more they can tell people that the success of those at the top is entirely because of their own work, which is the basic assertion of Ayn Rand's novel, then they can distort people's views on inequality and progressive taxation and the role of government. And so I think, you know, they're bankrolling. And James Allison's another one that's been doing a lot of funding of, he's been giving $2 million grants to universities to teach courses on capitalism with Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged as required reading. And 60 major universities and schools have already taken him up on that offer. And so, but they're not doing this out of benevolence. They're doing this because they recognize it serves a political agenda. It undermines investments in the common good. It justifies extreme inequality. And it really, in the end, in our view, it leads people to support public policies that are counterproductive to the kind of broadly shared prosperity we need.
You know, maybe this is a question I should have asked earlier, and it has to do with social and class mobility. I've often said that we have something closer to a caste system, that people that are born poor stay poor, middle class stay middle class. If you're wealthy, you stay wealthy. We've talked a little about the latter part of that. But the idea that there is a lot of upward mobility is part of the self-made myth, the title of your book. Am I being unfair or I guess inaccurate would be a better word, in saying that we have something closer to a caste system than a social structure that has class mobility upward?
No, I don't think you're being unfair at all. I think there is some truth to that. And I think what's important to know is, yeah, there is some social mobility, and social mobility being, of course, the ability of a person born to a low-income household to rise to middle or upper income in their lifetime. And conversely, someone born to a high-income household to fall back down. That's what sociologists refer to when they talk about this social mobility. But the thing is, when you look at the data, the U.S. actually has been social mobility in the U.S. has been declining for the last 20, 30 years, so that a person born now in low-income household has far less probability of rising up during their lifetime than someone born 30 years ago. And that's because we've been increasingly becoming a nation of haves and have-nots. And it's we need to turn the clock back. We need to go back to a time when wealth and income were a little more evenly distributed. And I think it's no coincidence that some of the most robust economic growth this nation has seen was in the 1950s and 60s in that post-war period when wealth and income was much more equitably shared in this country.
You know, someone, and I see we're almost out of time, so I should get this in quickly. There may be somebody listening and saying, that doesn't make any sense. When I was, my first job in the 1970s, I made $2.35. And now my wife and I together make $75,000. And hey, look at that. That shows you I made this upward mobile success.
Well, you know, I think there are some people who've gone up, there's some people who've gone down, but I think by and large, most of middle class America has not seen a salary increase in about 20 something years. And the data supports that. Almost all the income growth we've seen as a nation has gone to that very narrow sliver at the top of our economy. The top 1%, the top 5%.
Well, also, too, as I said, that someone when they're 21 years old, 40 years ago makes one thing, and then now he and his wife together, you know, that's part of it. But we do have just a bit more, and that's good because I don't want to leave this on a negative note. You actually have a degree of optimism about what we can do. I never did get into the fact that Bill Gates wrote one of the forewords. Where does your hope lie? Does it think that that people like Bill Gates Sr. and Jr. will act out of conscience, or is it something greater than that?
Well, I think the hope really comes from many factors. I mean, part of my hope comes from the dramatic increase of awareness that Occupy has brought us. But we've also seen more and more high-wealth people, and not just Bill Gates. I mean, there's tons of people we profile in this book. Abigail Disney, Gunn Denhart, founder of Hannah Anderson, Nikhil Arora, founder of Back to the Roots, and all these business people who speak out and recognize that it is not in their interest even to have the kind of inequality we have in this nation, and that there's more and more people speaking out. And I would invite any of your listeners to visit the website, selfmademyth.org, and get involved. We have a book tour coming up, but we also have there's a place on there where a person can tell their story. If you're a business leader, if you're a business owner, and you agree with what we've been saying here, that business success relies – hard work is important, no doubt, but so are the vast array of public investments – tell your story, write letters to the editor, get involved. It's important that we change the narrative around wealth creation. Just like the Koch brothers recognize that if they can get people to buy into the self-made myth, we recognize that we need folks to realize the built-together reality.
Well, we're out of time.
The nation.
Sorry, Brian. Brian, there's the clock looking at me. Brian Miller, thank you so much. Along with Mike Lapham, he has written The Self-Made Myth and the Truth About How Government Helps Individuals and Businesses Succeed, selfmademyth.org, and peterwerby.com. Brian Miller, thanks a lot for joining me.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. 101 WRIF.
Welcome to
Everything That Rocks.
Ever hear somebody say we can do this the easy way or we can do it the hard way? I mean, what kind of a choice is that? At Geico.com, everything's easy. Easy to see how much you can save on car insurance. Easy to go paperless by automatically paying your bill online. Easy, easy, easy. So visit Geico.com today. Of course, if you prefer the hard way, I guess you'll have to go someplace else. Sorry, I just don't get it.
Mike Rowe here. So I'm at a Ford dealer talking with customers about how taking care of your car is kind of like taking care of yourself. And I ask, which is in better shape, you or your car? Hint, the answer has four wheels.
Get the works. An oil change, tire rotation, and more for $39.95 or less minus a $10 mail-in rebate. That's $29.95. Click on the banner ad now. Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Rebate by check. See participating Ford dealer for exclusions and rebate details through 8/31/13.
Are kids better off in an intact family? You bet they are. This is Joe Cordell of the domestic litigation firm of Cordell & Cordell. Kids living in a household with married parents do better in school, are emotionally healthier, and are more likely to stay out of trouble with the law. If you're a man in a troubled marriage, my advice to you is to do everything you can to save your marriage, if only for your kids' sake. This includes considering alternatives to divorce, such as a legal separation or orders of protection. Of course, in some circumstances, divorce is unavoidable. In either case, if you're a man facing a crisis in your marriage, let us help you at Cordell & Cordell. We're the partner men can count on.
The attorneys at Cordell & Cordell work to help men maximize their role in their children's lives, which includes protecting men's financial means to do so. Call the domestic litigation firm of Cordell & Cordell. Offices in Troy, Novi, and Ann Arbor. 313-465-1999. That's 313-465-1999. Or visit online at CordellCordell.com.
101 WRIF.
I'm
WRIF HD1 Detroit. It's back to the links, July 22nd, the 2013 Riff Rockin' Golf Outing. Details at WRIF.com.